a better way. And we are live, and by some stretch of luck, actually on time. Had some delays this morning, but we are going to have a great show today. We're kind of continuing our Meet the Expert Council series, this time with a good friend of mine, and he and his wife are good friends with Dorothy and I. Joel Riles is going to be on again. I think I first had Joel Riles on the show over a decade ago, I think about 10 years. I know they were still living in Alaska, if that dates it at all for him. He's waiting on us in the green room right now. And we've had a lot of great discussions with Joel. I love Joel because we share some common interests. One is building businesses, and two is dogs. We have different approaches to dogs. Like, I like my kind of homestead dog, and he trains these awesome protection dogs. But dogs are dogs, man. And we've hung out a lot. We've probably drank more alcohol together than we should. We've smoked a cigar or two together. He's just a great guy, and he brings a lot to the table, teaching dog training as a core, but also business building and resiliency, and has an incredible outlook toward freedom and liberty as well. So he's a good friend of the show, good friend to us, and he is a hell of a great addition to the Expert Council. And after today, if you're new to the show, maybe you have more ideas of ways that you can send in questions and ask for his help on Expert Council shows on a weekly basis. Before we bring Joel on, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is JM Bullion. You guys know I'm big on Bitcoin, and I've been big on Bitcoin since pretty much Bitcoin has been Bitcoin. But that doesn't mean that I'm opposed to other hard assets. Silver and gold are two great monetary assets. They have multi-thousand year history as monetary assets. They've never been worth zero, and I don't think they ever will be. And we should all be stacking at least a little bit of silver and gold as part of our wealth assurance program. And if you're going to do that, then there's a couple things you want to do. You want to deal with a company you know you can trust. That's JM Bullion. You want to deal with a company that if there's a problem, you know it's going to get fixed, because problems happen. That's JM Bullion. I can email the president if I have to. I hadn't had to do it in like a couple of years, but I can if I need to. That was one of my requirements when I brought on JM Bullion as a sponsor. I need to be able to speak to the dude at the top, or we're not doing this. And then they ship all orders free, and if you're an MSB member, you get a discount. So check them out today at jmbullion.com. And remember, if you are an MSB member, make sure you get your discount. Next up today is Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason, and you can find his website at usaberkeyfilters.com. Water is life. It's one of the most important things that we need to worry about as preppers, and on a daily basis, you want to drink the healthiest and safest water possible. If you're on a well, that's great, but that also means that nobody tests your water unless you do, and if you're on city water, which most people are, that means that when you get a boil water advisory, you're already drinking something you weren't supposed to for a couple days before they figured it out. Either way, it's a good idea to filter your water, and if you ask me, it makes water just taste better. Check out usaberkeyfilterstoday.com. And if you're going to get a Berkey system, which is a great idea, get it from Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason, the original Berkey guy, not some guy that started selling Berkeys at a gun show 2 weeks ago. With that, let's bring our special guest on, Joel Riles. Joel, man, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jack. It's great to be here.
I'm glad to have you on, man. Like I said, we're doing kind of a Meet the Expert Council series. Ken Daniels kind of kicked that off. I thought it was a good idea. Some people like you have been on the show quite a few times, but even you haven't been on for a while. I looked it up, and it's quite a while ago. So for people to get familiar with you that maybe haven't met you before, either in real life or on air, kind of who are you? What is your background?
Yeah, so I started in the Army way back in 2001. And got back from my second deployment, and my ex-wife, she was my wife at the time, was like, okay, I got deployments are a thing in our life, but if you're going to be gone like this, I want a dog in the house. And that kind of kicked off in 2003, my obsession, that's probably the best way to describe it, with dogs. We got a puppy, and I went up and started training with the company that I worked with for about 12 years. And I would go up almost every single 4 day weekend we had in the Army, which, you know, in the Army is like 10 months out of the year.
Yeah.
And if I wasn't deployed, I was up there training on 4 day weekends. And so I did that for 10 to 12 years pretty consistently, and then pretty much went full time doing it myself after that. And I've been training now since 2003. So it's 22 years as of March of this last year. So that's pretty cool. And I've just been obsessed with it ever since. I used to tell people all the time that I learned more about warfighting training dogs than I actually got training in the military for it. And it served me well on my deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Absolutely, man. So can you talk about, like, what really made you passionate about this thing? Because I know there's a lot of people that, even if they're entrepreneurs, they do something because they can make money doing it. This is something you can make money doing, for sure. It's not always easy, but you can. But I can see that your passion led here.
Yeah, this was something when I do my podcast, which I've been on hold since the move, I'm looking forward to getting that started up again. But I would tell people, try and find the thing that you can't not do. And I would try to explain to people, a lot of people say passion, and what they mean by that is, oh, it's something you really like. And I'm like, that's not what passion is. Passion is something you're willing to suffer to do. The first time the word passion was used was referencing Christ on the cross and the crucifixion. So he was passionate about it. That's why they call it the passion of the Christ. So it's not just something you like. It's something you're willing to suffer to keep doing. And in the last couple of years, I've kind of realized not everybody has that. And I guess if you don't, then maybe being an entrepreneur isn't for you. Maybe your passion is your family and you just want to work a regular job and spend time with your wife and kids. And if that's you, that's great. But if you want to run a business and you want to be resilient when things get really, really tough, and I don't know if it's like this for everybody, but everybody that I've talked to that runs their own business is like, there's lots of times when it's really, really tough. You can build it up where it gets smoother, but if you get lazy, it's going to get really tough again. Like, you got to manage it and maintain it and keep it going. And in order to do that, you got to be willing to suffer for it. Now, for me personally, I wanted to be a soldier since I was like 12 years old. I think when I was in that age range, I saw a poster of the Rangers, and it was, you know, a little Zodiac, and they were in the swamps and laying prone in the Zodiac with their little caps on and their rifles sticking out. And I went, that's what I want to do. And that pretty much stuck with me till I went in the Army. And then I went in as an officer and realized officers don't get to do all the cool stuff that the enlisted guys do. Like, there's downsides to being enlisted, that's for sure. But one of the upsides is you get to do all the cool stuff. Most of the officers just stand back and watch you do cool stuff. So I wanted to do the cool stuff. And when I started training with the dogs, that is essentially my mentor's mentor, as the story goes, was his name was Gunther, and he was the Nazi K9 SS battalion commander for the K9 units. And he fled to Canada after the war. Met my mentor, and my mentor was a McAfee SOG veteran from Vietnam. And so everything we did with the dogs was like basic training with dogs. Okay. And so it was like every time we went, it was, can we make these guys quit? And I just fell in love with it. It was one of those things that I was like, this is all I want to do. I would come when I was back home, I'd come in at the end of the day. And if it was raining outside, I would go in the house. I'd say, see you in an hour. I'd grab my dogs and I'd go out into the rain and we'd be crawling through the mud, teaching dogs to crawl on the ground, not get up. It's raining. It's miserable. Yep. And we're both out here doing it. And that just was something that I became obsessed with. And so I was, you know, it literally was something that I couldn't not do. I tried to do other things. I tried to work, you know, outside the Army. I tried to do other things and I just kept coming back to it. And at some point I just said, I'm going to stop fighting it and just go full time.
You know, the follow your passion in business is advice I've given for years, and it's good advice because I don't care how much you love what you do. And I don't even care about, like, some days will be hard. Like, that's just it. There's going to be some days you don't want to do it.
Yep.
There's going to be days when you're like, you know what I want to do today? In the words of Peter Gibbons from Office Space, absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do today. And you can build in days that you do absolutely nothing, but the days you want to do absolutely nothing will be a day that you did not build it in. Like, it's not a day off that was planned, and there'll be 10 things that absolutely need to happen that day to keep your business on track.
Yep.
And if you're passionate about your business, you will effing do them, right? No matter how much you don't want to, you will do them. If you are not passionate, you might do some of them maybe, right? On that day, on that hard day. And then the problem is, like anything, it's a habit. And once you start, when you do something three times, it goes into habit form. So three times you slack off, all of a sudden it becomes a habit to slack off your business.
Yep.
That happens at work all the time. And in a lot of jobs, you can freaking get away with it. I mean, there's a lot of employees, they work half of the time they're paid to work, and it's enough to keep their employer from firing them. You can't do that running a business. You have to want it. And the business gurus that say things like, don't follow your passion, find a market need. I guarantee you, your passion has freaking market need.
Right.
Right? Just find the match point.
Yeah, and if you're not finding the market in your passion, I think the problem there is you're not marketing it properly. Mm-hmm. You're not telling people what it is you actually do in a way that connects to them. It helped me a lot, too. So, like, I found you back in 2009.
Okay.
And then it was your fault that I stopped following you for a while because you told me to go start a business. And so I went, okay. And I started like down, you know, this was before YouTube and all this kind of stuff was really kicking off, at least for that kind of information. So it was like CDs of, you know, entrepreneurial boot camp, you know, 1 week conference type things.
Yeah.
And I was buying all those, going to the conferences, trying to figure out how to start businesses. And, I was going somewhere with that. So we were talking about the passion thing. Oh, and so at some point I figured out you've also got to, you've got to tell people what it is you're doing in a way that they understand. And you sometimes have to make adjustments to it. So it might not be the exact thing you thought you were going to sell. Like one of the things I learned real quick, and you mentioned this, because you're a sponsor for Canine Academy, is sometimes you go a couple months without selling a trained protection dog. Now, if you've got a nice savings in the bank, which normally we try to have unless you have to move or something like that, reestablish your facility, then that covers down on it. But if you want something that's going to cover those middle times, you need to kind of build it out where it has redundancy in it. And so one day I was thinking I should record some videos so that when people get puppies, they know how to train their puppies so that, you know, my Mallies don't end up in a shelter somewhere because, you know, it ate somebody's couch. And so I got the idea to start videoing some training. And then all of a sudden it just hit me like, why am I being stupid? This should definitely be a thing where I build it out for everybody, for all dogs. And then that can be an online training course. And at the time, nobody else had any online training courses. And so I was like, all right, cool. And then when we started breeding, it was like, well, I have more pups in this litter than I'm going to train for protection dogs. I can sell some puppies from the litters. And then I have, it's not as much money as a protection dog, but it's something that keeps some money coming in between when you get those big dog sales. And so when people are thinking about, this is the thing I'm passionate about, I want to do it. It's okay. And then how can you also take that and create other products that might be more popular than the thing that is your true passion, but will still make you money and allow you to do the stuff that you're passionate about.
Yeah, I liken that to an old gun from the African safari days called a drilling, where you had a double rifle, something like a 375 H&H side by side, so you could shoot anything from an elephant down to a gazelle with that. But you couldn't shoot a guinea fowl or a rabbit or something like that. And so these guys that were out on these trips back then, like, they lived on what they shot.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed something that if the lion came out and tried to eat them and they shot the lion, it would die before it ate them. They needed something to put a big meat animal down so that they could feed the whole party. But, you know, when they came across a flock of guinea fowl, which are not the hardest thing in the world to shoot, if you shoot it with a 375, you get, right? So they needed some way to feed themselves in between the big harvests. And that's exactly what that gun did. And that's how I tell people to build businesses, especially if you have a big ticket item. Like one of your fully trained 2-year-old dogs, that's expensive. That's an investment. It's worth it. But there are just people that will never do it because they don't have the money.
Right.
Right. And they can't figure out how to get the money. And like there's other things they need to do. And there's people you would tell them, don't do this right now. This is not right for you. Like you know, but you got to have something to sell in between when you're a big ticket business. And that's why I think that was a great product rollout for you.
Yeah. And the other thing, I was passionate about this early on too. And it's something that we're slowly starting to, it seems like we're moving beyond, but I still in my heart want to keep it going, is when I first got a protection dog, I couldn't afford to buy a fully trained protection dog.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I bought a puppy and then I invested the time and I went up and I trained and I invested the time in between and I brought the dogs up to, you know, the level of what we sell them at now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I couldn't afford a fully trained dog at the time. So it was kind of my passion when I started the company to be able to provide protection dogs to people no matter what their financial situation was, if they were willing to do it, right? If they really wanted it. And I often will tell clients, if you have more time than you have money, then buy a puppy and put the time into it, and you can come for 3 to 5 day sessions spread out over, you know, 3 to 6 months in between sessions to get the dog to where you want it, but you're the one putting the energy into it. Or if you have more money than you have time, then pay me to do the work for you, because I know how to not make all the mistakes you're going to make if you're doing it yourself. Yeah. You've been doing it for over 20 years. But it was something that I really wanted people to have the ability to do this, because at least for our family, having those dogs there is such a peace of mind that if something happens, that I've got a battle buddy in the fight if I have to go and fight somebody.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the word mistakes there, and that's something we try to help people avoid when we're good business consultants, and good business salespeople should be consultants. So when families are considering adding a protection dog to their home, what should be the main things they consider?
Well, the first one is just some basic things like, are you allergic to dogs? Obviously, if you have some kind of issue like that, then you're going to have to look for a specific type of dog at least. One of the things we do in our phone consults is we want to know about your lifestyle. So do you have children? Are you active? Are you, you know, you just come to work and then come home and chill out on the couch? What's your lifestyle like? And we want to try and pick a dog that's going to fit that lifestyle. So if you're talking to someone about getting a dog and you're docile, right? And you just like to chill out and relax and sit on your couch, well, then probably don't get a Malinois. Or if you're going to get a Malinois, find somebody who's like, yeah, there's something wrong with this one in the litter. He's really calm and relaxed. Wow. Like, you get those occasionally, right? Not normal. But maybe something like a German Shepherd, who's a little bit more on the you know, lower energy side. Of course, sometimes because we cross our lines, we'll get, I call them Malinois and German Shepherd bodies, where you get a German Shepherd that acts like a Malinois. But most of the time, when the dog looks like the breed, it acts like the breed. That's been our experience over the years. So you want to get a dog that kind of fits your lifestyle. You also want to get a dog that's the size that you want it. So some people are really obsessed with big dogs. If you move a lot with your dog, you probably don't want a 100-pound dog. You probably want something more in the somewhere between 50 and 70 pounds.
Yeah.
That can get in your car easily. If you're going to fly on planes, it can lay at your feet and you still have some foot room to you know, be comfortable. And so you want a dog that's going to fit size-wise, it's going to fit your personality. And then if actual protection is your concern and not just deterrence, because having a dog is a great deterrent.
Yeah.
But I often liken it to, it's kind of like carrying a gun with no bullets in it. It's like if you're relying on it just as a deterrent and you say, you know, I just want this dog. I don't want to, you know, I don't have the money to invest for the protection work, but it'll look scary and intimidating and it will probably keep people away from me. Well, that's probably true and it will probably work. But drawing a pistol and pointing it at somebody will probably make them leave you alone. But if they go, you're not going to pull the trigger and they charge at you, or they draw a weapon because you drew a weapon and theirs actually has bullets in it and yours doesn't. Now you're in a world of hurt. And so, but having that, like, what do you actually think your level of risk is? What do you actually think the level of fight you're going to have to bring into a situation is? You know, it's like anything else. If you're trying to fortify your property, you know, you could spend $100 million fortifying your property if you wanted to do every possible thing that you could do to get it, you know, as secure as possible, to include having, you know, like paid guards on site and everything else. Or you could put up some signs and some cameras and a gate and a fence and go, that's good enough for me. And everybody's got their range of, this is the level of security that I want. And it also depends on your history. Like, I just had a potential client I was talking to this morning who was sex trafficked. And so obviously she's like much more aware of the fact that bad things do happen because a really bad thing happened to me, and I'm willing to invest to have this level of protection. And so all of those things kind of go into the idea. And then in terms of picking breeds, you know, I probably my most frequent question at events that I go to is, I have this breed, can we turn it into a protection dog? And I'm like, okay, when you're buying a dog for anything, livestock guardian dog, homestead dog, protection dog, hunting dog, the very first thing you should look at is, what breeds were bred to do the thing I want to do with my dog?
Agreed.
Not I like the look of that dog. Like, some people really like the look of pit bulls, and pit bulls can be great dogs. And a lot of the ways pit bulls are bred now, they're good family pets. Or if you want a really good hunting dog, pit bulls and black mouth curs and things like that are some of your best catch dogs. But if you take one of those dogs, because pit bulls tend to, especially the ones that are good hunting dogs, which are the ones that would make good protection dogs potentially, they become obsessive you put them on pigs, and that dog gets loose, it's going to find a pig somewhere, and it's going to start crushing it. I've known guys who have trained pit bulls to hunt squirrels, and they'll tree squirrels. But they get super obsessive about squirrels. If they hear a little, you know, rustle in the leaves in the woods, buddy, they're out there, and they're trying to figure out where that squirrel is. And so if you take a dog like that and put it on humans, then the concern in my mind is they're obsessive about biting humans.
Yeah.
Whereas if you take a dog for – in the protection realm specifically, if you take a dog for the last 200 to 300 years that's been bred to work alongside shepherds in the field, but also work with militaries and to work with law enforcement, it's those dogs make ideal dogs for protection. So make sure that you pick a breed first that's useful in what you want to do. And then, okay, maybe there's five breeds that do that. Then pick the one you want that maybe you like the look of best.
I would agree with all that, especially the comments on pit bulls. As you know, I had a pit mix, and he was an amazing dog, and I loved him. And he was a very friendly animal once you were let in. But I feel like I made a huge mistake with him. I weaponized that dog about people trying to get inside that gate. And that dog went from cuddle up with your toddler and not worry to I will murder you like that. And because I didn't really – I'd never trained a dog to do that before.
Right.
And so I didn't put the right off switch on that dog.
Yeah.
And I think that even if you do it right, that particular breed, off is going to mean off after I get the arm off. And then I'll stop, right? Like, I mean, they just don't – they don't have a quit button, and they also have a ridiculous pain tolerance. I mean, it is – I've seen my dog ripped his face up trying to get a rat out of a aluminum downspout.
Yep.
Right? And he didn't care that he was ripping his face up.
Yep.
And so I think you got to have a breed that has enough courage – to do the job, and has enough dog self-control, I guess, innate that if you train it, because your dogs, it's amazing how quick your dogs shut off. I mean, it's get them, stop. And it's nine times out of 10, it's the millisecond you say it. And at most, it's like one more bite and then they let go. Like,
you know.
And the older they get and the more experience they have, the quicker that release comes. And I can't see... My old dog that I lost a year ago, had we trained him even that way, I can't see him ever having that level of control to release because they're aggressive.
Well, that breed was bred for that particular quality.
Yes.
Is bite and hold on. You know, when they were using them to hunt pigs, the whole idea was you had six or eight of these dogs and they were grabbing the pig from all different angles and they were all pulling.
Yep.
So that it immobilized the pig.
And then you could come in like a hero and stab it, right?
Yeah. And for that purpose, it was great. But when you take that and try and put it on a human, that becomes a significant problem. And then, you know, if you're getting into the protection side of things, then it becomes like any other protection aspect in the world is which perspective of the trainer do you most connect with? So if you're into martial arts, you know, there's Krav Maga, there's MMA, there's what Sistema, there's all these different techniques and methodologies you can use. And some people go and learn them all. And if you have the time for that, that's great. And some people have a specific one that they focus on and they just, you know, spend a year or two kind of learning it and then hope that it's, you know, comes back to them if they ever need it. In the dog world, we train our dogs to actually fight a human being because we're not training apprehension dogs. Like law enforcement has the purpose of their dogs in terms of using their mouth and biting is for apprehension. And if the officer deploys that dog and it bites somebody, the purpose is hold on to this person, create enough pain that they're hopefully not going to fight back. And the officer will be here in a second to slap handcuffs on him.
Yep.
But if you are moving with a dog in public or you have a dog in your home and people are reconning that and they go, yeah, they have a really obviously trained Malinois or Dutch Shepherd or German Shepherd in their house, we're still going to pick them as the people we're going to attack. The level of threat that's there is way higher than the vast majority of the people that police are deploying their dogs on. You know,
I think it's,
Go ahead. I was just going to say for the police dogs, 90% of the time the people are either running or hiding. And both of those signify, I don't want the fight.
Yeah.
And when the person does fight back, that's when the dogs end up getting killed.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they don't know how to handle it. Because I was going to get to that. Like, I think it's not just breed. It's also like breeding lines and it's how the dogs train, but it's also size. I think that a lot of people think bigger is better. I had a 150-pound shepherd and that's when he was over. He was 140 pounds of lean.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, if that dog grabbed on you, you had a freaking problem. I mean, no doubt about it. But he did not have the agility that one of your dogs has. And there's no way he could have, and he didn't – he was actually pretty impressive. But he could grab Frisbee 6.5, 7 foot out of the air in his prime. Mm-hmm. But his prime didn't last as long as a smaller dog either. So had I taken that dog from a pup – now, I got him when he was 18 months, but let's say I got him when he was a pup. It would have taken him 2 years to get him where you really have him dialed in.
Yep.
Most dogs you're going to go from about 8 years after that investment, around 10 years of age, he would have been, you know, retired from that line of work at 8, 8.5. Because the body size and all just wears the joints, and he would have never had the agility. When we got Belle from you, and we didn't protection train her at all, but we did obedience train her. But when we were playing with her, and I would do things like try to grab her, and I'd watch one of your videos when you use a stick, like a rubber stick to spar with the dog, and I watched the way that dog, it actually her dad, right, moved around that stick. I'm like, oh, I've seen that move. Yep. It was an 8 to her to make that move, like, not just to get away from a stick. I was just trying to grab her collar. And she's like, bullshit. And the agility of those type of dogs bred in those kind of lines like you do is something I do not believe a person gets until they see it.
Until they see it, yeah. Well, one of the fun things is I'll have guys want to learn to do bite training, right? And so they'll come over and they'll get in the bite suit. And the dogs sometimes, especially the smaller females, those smaller females are lightning fast. And I've had guys try to hit the dogs, you know, so they bite one arm, right? And we go to strike them on the other arm and they're
immediately on the other arm, right?
Right. And they're like, I can't even see her switching because just the flash of your arm going between your eyes and the dog.
He's over there.
A second. And then what happens is they get so fast and they start to read us.
Yeah.
That you just shift your shoulders and they see that shoulder shift. I'm like, you better have your arm between your face and that dog's mouth. And you shift your shoulders because they're so fast. They will come up, and if your arm's not there for them to catch, they're hitting you in the face.
This is the Mike Tyson peekaboo shit that they're pulling on you there, man. Yeah. They are incredibly fast, and then because of the speed, there's also the impact. So you see these, like some of these, like mine's about 65 pounds, and she probably should be 60, Dorothy. Anyway, a 65-pound dog does not look that big. Like you said, they can curl up. Like if we take her somewhere, like to a restaurant or whatever, we put the service dog vest on her and all, so we just – lay her down and everybody leaves her be. But a 65-pound dog, I don't know if you've ever clocked what their actual run speed is, but whatever it is, force times mass, force times acceleration equals mass times acceleration equals force. And the force is significant because of the speed. And they're also just dense.
Yes.
They're just muscle.
Yep. Yeah. One of my favorite bite deployments we ever did. I had a 65-pound female German Shepherd, and we were doing deployments this day where we were putting the dogs 50 yards down on one side of us, and then we had the bad guy 50 yards down on the other side, and our job was to lay prone in the middle and without saying any words, get the dog to deploy on the bad guy. And then his job that day was because the dog has a 100-yard sprint into him, right?
Yeah.
Was to try to not let the dog bite him.
Okay.
And so – we were kind
of the dog's got to make 100. The guy's got to make 50. Is that how that's working?
Well, the dog's running 100 yards to him, and then his job is to try and dodge out of the way when the dog charges by because it's in full speed.
Okay, I got you.
So its ability to change direction is slightly hindered.
Yeah.
And so he was a lot of the dogs will jump, especially when they're running at full speed like that, like 10, 15 yards out and fly through the air. Well, she had a tendency to do that. And so she jumped about 10 yards out and was in the air. And he tried to like smack her chest as she came by and push her and step out of the way. And her neck was long enough. She reached around and grabbed the front of the suit right in the chest. And as soon as she latched on, I jumped up and started closing distance.
Yeah.
And it was like slow motion. It's like she did a full like 360 hanging onto the suit and he's just spinning through the air. And then they both hit the ground together.
Yeah.
And as soon as they hit the ground, I was like, ow, Plutz, leave it. And she ran like 3 inches from his face.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Please move. Give me a reason to bite you in the face. It was just that, it's that agility you're talking about where even mid flight, and a lot of times if they do that and they launch early, we actually try to train them not to do that because that is a vulnerability. But even if you smack them off, they hit the ground, stop, and run right back in and bite. But she had that agility midair, and she was just big enough that she got a hold of that and And if you get bit in the chest or the upper arms, it's like, especially with our dogs, because they don't drive into the bite, they thrash out once they get a hold of you. Just the muscle damage that happens in those fights is intense.
It's an FAFO animal, man.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how to create a practical family protection plan. The dog is part of it, maybe not the only thing.
Yeah, so I always recommend to people, if you're the type of person that thinks about family protection, having a defensive plan and all of that kind of stuff, then what you want to start with is make sure that you're aware of the surroundings of your house. So a couple ways you could do that. You could do things like cameras. You can do things like making sure that you're checking windows and stuff like that so that you're aware of your surroundings. But most people, even if they have cameras, if they're not motion sensing cameras that alert you when there's something out there, you're not even going to know other than going and checking after the fact. So having a dog, even if it's a yippy dog, in your home gives you much more situational awareness of what's going on outside your home, because dogs are hyper situationally aware and they're also very territorial. So once they're in your home, they're very able to alert you that something's going on out there that's out of the ordinary. And then you can decide whether it's something you need to check out or not, right? Because it could be a raccoon in the trash can, could be a possum checking things out, or it could be a person outside the house. But having that ability to see or be aware of what's going on outside our surroundings, that's really one of the biggest weaknesses in our home, is we tend to be most comfortable in our home. And so when we're at home, we just want to relax. Like if you carry a concealed weapon, you typically take it off when you get home, because I'm home. This is where bad things don't happen. This is the place where I can relax. And then the next step is, if something like a home invasion is something that you're trying to defend against, is having a setup where the people in your house know what to do should something happen, right? Where are the firearms in your house? Are they close by, or do you have to go get them? Are they, you know, is there a shotgun at the front door, which in general is not the best defensive plan, because if somebody kicks your front door in, there's a gun right there they can grab. But, you know, each family has to set up their own plan, but you want to have, where are the tools that I need, and are they where they're supposed to be for my plan to work, right? Because if your plan is, I have a shotgun underneath the couch, and if somebody kicks my front door and I reach under the couch and grab the shotgun, there better be a shotgun under the couch or that plan doesn't work. Right. So we want to make sure we know what tools we're going to use and that the tools are where they're supposed to be. But again, the problem is, in our houses, we generally want to relax, including myself. Like if I was carrying, you know, concealed, I don't want to sit down on my couch with a small of the back, you know, carry pistol. And that's uncomfortable to sit on the couch and relax and watch TV.
Yeah.
So where are your weapons and can you get to them on time? And so, again, adding the dog in for that, a lot of what they're doing in those situations is buying you time. They're the distraction. They're engaging. They're causing damage and injury, but they're buying you time so that you can either, if you're in a parking lot and you get attacked and you have your children with you, I can run to my car. They're buying me that time where the person's focused on something other than me and my children. If I'm in my house and I have to go and get a gun that's in the bedroom or whatever, they're buying me the time to be able to do that. And if I'm in my vehicle, then they're engaging and they're buying me time, but they're also pushing people away from the vehicle so that I can use the vehicle to get away. And you can, there's lots of other tools that you can add in there, but the thing that happens with the dog is it takes all of those tools and it makes them two or three times more effective, because they add that extra time that you need, which is really your most critical asset in those situations. Is most people, if you don't train for a interpersonal conflict, most people will freeze up. And if you haven't run scenarios or done scenario training where you kind of have a reaction to those situations, then even if you do something, the chances that it's going to be effective are really low. Mm. And, you know, you might try and beat on somebody, but if you're small and they're big, then, okay, your beating on them is not going to be very effective. If you haven't trained, and people don't realize this, and just going and doing some kind of martial art, a basic martial art, something where somebody's going to punch you or kick you, and just get punched or kicked a couple times and realize the first couple times that happens, you're like, you don't know what's going on. I remember as a kid, the very first time I got in a fight, we were talking about each other's mamas, right? As like 8 or 12 year old kids do. And
your mama.
Exactly. And I don't even remember what started the argument, but all of a sudden I was looking at the sky and I was thinking to myself, why am I looking at the clouds? And my head came back down and whap, I looked at the clouds again. I wasn't even feeling any pain. The kid started punching me in the face, and you're just looking at the sky, because that's what your head goes back when you get hit.
Yeah.
And so, well, I learned a couple things that day. Number one is, if there's going to be a fight, I'm throwing the first punch. All this stuff our moms told us about, don't throw the first punch. No. That's bullshit.
We'll go back to Star Wars on that, right? Hand fired first. There was a reason.
Exactly. If there's going to be a fight, you move first. Now, if you can avoid the fight, that's great. But just experiencing that and then going, okay, down the road, as I started doing more and more of that type of training, and it became much more natural. And then watching when clients come and they've never had a situation like that, just holding a dog while it lunges and starts biting, like they go into shutdown mode. Like the stress level of just that, which is a super basic drill that we do. It's like, I'll be talking to them while the dog's biting and they can't hear me. They're like hyper focused on the dog. That's the only thing they can see. They have like super tunnel vision on the dog. And that's the only thing that's going on in their world. And if a second person were to be attacking them in that situation, they wouldn't know it until the person was already on them. And so just doing something where you start training yourself to deal with stress, so that when and if a situation like that happens, you have some idea of what to do and how to react, so that you're not just shut down. And those things are your kind of base layers of getting a protection plan in place, is being able to deal with some stress and having some level of plan for what you're going to do. And if you're like anti-gun, well, then you need to have some way to defend yourself without guns. Mm-hmm. Maybe you use a baseball bat. Maybe you use a golf club. Whatever it is, have mace and pepper spray in the house. But especially for people that are anti-gun, something like a dog is able to add a big benefit there. And then the last thing I always go over with people, and my women clients, my female clients tend to accept this a lot more than my male clients, because they're like, nah, man, I'll just do it, is if you carry a firearm and someone starts to like become aggressive with you, in our minds, I remember specifically having this situation where I was going to Walmart late at night to get something for the family that they needed. I think somebody got sick and we needed something from the store, and it was pouring down rain. I don't know why, but everybody was at Walmart. There was like the parking lot was full. And so I'm driving around for like 10 minutes trying to find a parking place. And finally somebody backs out and I pull into the parking place, and all of a sudden my door opens.
Yeah.
And I look up and it's this dude all pissed off because I, quote unquote, took his parking place.
Oh, I've had those. Yeah.
Yeah. And in my mind, I'm like, this is a one way road and you were going the wrong way. So no, that wasn't your parking place. Yeah. But it didn't matter because the door's open and the dude's standing there yelling at me. Right.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
Now, I might be able to justify jumping up and pushing him or even hitting him, but I couldn't justify in that moment shooting him.
No.
And what ended up happening, you know, whether this was the best situation or not, because I never anticipated this until this moment happened, right, is I stood up and I'm trapped in the corner between the door and the car frame. And we ended up fighting and going to ground. And then he jumped up and ran off. And not a huge threat situation, but it was a situation where it's like that could have gone really bad.
They could have. You don't know.
Right. And if he had drawn a weapon, then I was already too close for me to have drawn a weapon and engaged. But if I'd had a dog with me and he'd done that, the dog would have engaged. That would have been a provoked bite. So my dog and me are both good.
Yeah.
And the fight was over and I didn't have to engage with anybody.
Well, he probably had a dog on his face before you got out of the car.
Yep.
If you had a dog with you.
And the funny thing was, I was like 5 years into training dogs at that point.
Yeah.
And I just happened, because I was in a rush, I didn't take
Not have a dog with you.
Yep.
In fact, what probably would have happened is when he got to the door and looked in and saw the teeth looking at him, he would have thought, yeah, I don't know that I really want to do this. And if he did, that would have been an FA out of five and find out of freaking eight.
Yep.
The thing about the FAFO formula the guy did, like you do it out of five, you find out of five. That, don't rely on that, right? If you're the aggressor, right? Sometimes you FA out of five and find out at a nine.
Yeah.
You might not even be right, but once you open the can, you don't know what's coming.
Exactly.
And I think that, like, this is also why I tell people about carrying things like pepper spray. And I require Dorothy to have pepper spray with her, even though she's, you know, have all the guns you want, honey. But I don't believe that she's going to shoot somebody unless she really has to. I mean, like, and will she still have control of the weapon by the time she realizes that? I don't know. But I know she'll pepper spray the fuck out of you, right? I know at least that'll happen. And the people that tell me it doesn't work because they know some guy from Special Forces that put it on his food, I put hot sauce on my food all the time.
Well, that's
ice jalapenos like candy. You know what happens when you touch your face?
Exactly.
Like, there's a difference there. And some people take it for like, you know, like they seem like they're going to be okay. They're going to be able to fight. And it's about 30 seconds in, even with those people, that it just all like starts to fall apart for them.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose if you're really high on drugs, it might not affect you. But pepper spray in your mouth is probably not that big a deal. It's literally just cayenne pepper ground up super fine and, and some kind of liquid or foam that's sprayed out. What it affects is your mucous membranes. So when it hits your eyes and it gets in your nose, that's when your body goes, what the hell? And it just has an involuntary reaction. And now if you train to function through pepper spray, that's actually one of the things they teach you in the police academy. Yeah. Is how to function if you get pepper sprayed, and it's mostly because if you use it, you're going to get it.
You're going to get overspray, right? Yeah.
And so you can do things like strobing your eyes and stuff like that to work your way through the pepper spray, but that doesn't mean that for the next 7 days you're not going to be in intense pain. That was what I learned, was I could barely function for a week after because my eyes were so scratched up from strobing them during the pepper spray.
Yeah.
But everybody reacts to it in some way, and if you haven't trained to deal with it, you're going to have the reaction. And, you know, worst case, it doesn't do anything, but it's a momentary pause because you pull something out and start squirting it at people. And they're kind of like, what's that? What are you doing? And that momentary pause can give you, you know, that split second to either run away or do something else. But definitely having those weapons on hand, because the lethal stuff, we have much more hesitation to use. In fact, I remember specifically that guy that I just told you about when I was in that parking lot. We started fighting and I got a hold of his head at one point. And I had my thumbs in his eyes, and I was about to push my thumbs into his eyes. And all of a sudden, I realized, wait a minute, I can't kill this guy. If I kill this guy, I'm in big trouble. And it's like your brain is trying to process and figure out what's going on. And it's like, no. But if I had hesitated there and then he had been drawing a knife and I didn't realize it, stabbed me in the side, then again, now the whole dynamic changes. But that's the whole deal about a fight, is these things are constantly fluctuating and changing. And our reaction time is really slow to those things. We don't react particularly fast. And usually by the time we're reacting, whatever it is we're reacting to has already happened. Whereas with a dog, one of my favorite things is when we do attack on handler drills. And I tell my handlers, you know, walk this course, and when you get to this spot over there, I'm going to attack you. And, of course, I never attack them where I told them I'm going to attack them, because I'm like, why would you walk over there if you know somebody's going to attack you there? But I either attack them before that, or I wait till after when they're like, what? He was supposed to be here. Where is he? He said he was going to attack me here. And they start letting their guard down, and then I run out and attack them. But the whole idea is I want them to truly be surprised. So they can see the reaction speed and how fast the dog reacts and engages. And when I, especially when I attack them early and I come up from behind them, a lot of times they're like, I didn't even hear you. I didn't I didn't realize anything was going on until I heard you screaming because the dog was biting you. But that's the level of situational awareness that the dogs bring. They're just hypervigilant as a natural state.
They can see and sense and feel things that we can't. I'm completely convinced of that. You and I have talked about this. I don't think they actually hear that much better than us. They just hear at a broader range, meaning if it's a frequency both human and dog can hear, if you can't hear it, maybe they can hear just a little bit better than you, but not by much. But there is a sense that they have that is – you can't really explain it. It's like a sixth sense, like an energy – ability to sense energy. I think humans have it. They just have it better. They're closer to the predator that they are and the prey that they are than we are. And so they have more of that basal instinct. It's the thing that, like, you're in a deer stand, bow hunting, you hear nothing, you see nothing, you smell nothing. All of a sudden your hair stands up and that deer comes through. That dog has that times 10.
Right.
And that's part of how they're able to tell things. That's why a guy walks in your house and you invited him in and the dog's still like, no. Like, and your dog is just like, I'm not going to bite him or nothing, but you need to know that this motherfucker shouldn't be in your house. And that dog knows that. And I have never found a dog that otherwise likes people to be wrong about that. If that dog says something's up, you probably don't want that person around.
Yeah. My mentor used to say the dogs have access to a world we don't.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of validity to that. Like, people think when a dog is tracking, it's only using its nose. And I do think that they're using their nose when they're tracking or doing scent work. But we've had situations, you know, because everybody comes up with their theory. right? Yeah. Some theories for tracking are they crush the vegetation and they're detecting that. And yeah. Some theories are cells are sloughing off of us as we're walking around and that's what they're actually picking up. And I'm like, theories are all fine and great and there's nothing wrong with having a theory on why something happens. But I don't care why. This is one of my kind of like training philosophies. I don't care why a dog is doing a thing. I care that they're doing it.
Yeah.
And whether it's a misbehavior and I'm correcting it or whether they're tracking and I'm just accessing their capability to track. Because we've run tracking seminars where we have 20 people out tracking and there's a consistent wind that's blowing all day long. It's very like stable. It's not like swirling around. And for whatever reason on this day, every dog of the 20 tracked upwind of the tracks. Mm. And it's like, well, if the theory's right, all the scent should be downwind of the track. So if you're not on the track, you should be downwind. But all the dogs were tracking like 10 feet upwind. And yeah. I'm like, I don't know, but I know.
And if they find the target, then you don't, right? You just need to train the dog to find the target. And how it does it, you don't have the dog's brain, so you can't know what the dog knows. Like, as much as we try, and you're probably closer than most people to understanding the dog's brain and how the dog is thinking, and you still don't know. I don't know if you ever, did you ever see the Mythbusters with the dog tracking?
No, I didn't see that one.
Oh, it's fantastic. So they have Adam as the target.
Okay.
And Jamie's with the dog handler guy, and he goes and he does all the things. He goes through the creek, right? Mm-hmm. He wears a freaking deer suit, like the suits that archery hunters use with the charcoal filter. He sprays himself from head to freaking toe with that scent killer shit and all. Yep. And all they give the dog is like a t-shirt he wore yesterday. So none of the things that he's put on are the smell. Like they do it like scientific, very controlled.
Yep.
And that dog went straight to him.
Yep.
Like, I mean, and it was like one of like a trained tracking hound, like a blue tick or something. And it went, there was no deviation. It went right down the creek. He went out the side. It followed him back across the creek, down the creek, and then straight to the tree and like, fuckers up there.
Yep.
And they said, so what Jamie said is, I'm sure this works on deer, but it doesn't work on dogs. I'm not so sure it works on deer, but it definitely does. And that's where all of like the mythology around you can hide the cocaine and coffee and all. I'm like, this is all bullshit written by people that, you know, Google things for screenwriting. Like the dog will find you if the dog is trained to find you.
We used to say whether it was tracking or whether it was hiding items when we were training dogs for scent work is you can fool the handler, but you can't fool the dog. So if you're trying to defeat a tracker or you're trying to defeat, you know, I've got drugs or explosives or something.
Yeah.
You want to try and throw the handler off, not the dog. Cause it's really, really hard to throw the dogs off. We did that where we put all the equipment on and we did the, you know, scent soap that's supposed to take your scent off of you and all that. I will say it does alter the dogs if they haven't been exposed to that before.
Yeah.
They're kind of like, they act like it's like a 2-day old track instead of a new track.
Okay.
And so they have to look a little bit more to find the scent. Now, the hounds themselves are more sensitive to scent than the collies.
And this was probably like a dog trained to like find prisoners to get out of jail or something. Like this dog was full on. Like they took his tracking training to the level you take your protection training. Like that dog was going to go right to you.
Yep. But yeah, you cannot hide that. The thing about water is if you're in a creek that you can walk through, water does absolutely nothing. If you're in a creek, you have to swim across. Your scent is in the water, but it's moving. So we call that moving water. And so, but there's techniques that we've used over the years where, okay, well, how big is this creek or stream? Is it something that they likely swam across?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then we're going to, because when you're running a real track, a real search and rescue track, you don't have one dog. You typically have three or four.
Mm-hmm.
And so you send two guys on both directions down the stream. You know, a lot of times if they hit the stream and just started walking, your dog's just going to turn and go, right? But if they hit the stream and then they stop, like, okay, we lost scent, you work them up and down the stream just a little bit to see if they pick it up. And if not, then you go straight across and you work that side. And usually you'll have a person working this side and another person working the other side. And 9 times out of 10, depending on how fast the stream's flowing, they're downstream, not upstream. Because unless they're a really strong swimmer, they're not going to try and fight the current and go upstream.
Yeah.
So we know we're working downstream here. Put a dog on both sides of the stream and run the edge until they pick up scent. If you're in still water like a pond, they will – the scent – when they swim, the scent actually comes and floats and sits right under the film on the water. And so dogs will swim and bite at the water while they swim. And they're actually getting scent while they're biting at the water. Now, of course – most of the time, I'm probably not putting my dog in that water. If it's a big body of water, we might get a boat and work that. But if it's a small body of water, I'm probably just walking around the outside of it until I pick up the scent where they came out. And if it's a small body of water, they probably didn't go in it anyway. Now, if you're looking cadaver dogs where, you know, an older person may have wandered in or a child may have wandered into the water and drowned, well, that's a whole different skill set. But the there are ways of working water obstacles. And if the handler knows what they're doing and the dog is a tracking dog, you're not getting away from those dogs.
No, you're not. I think it's also one of the better skills to teach a dog. You don't have to have a protection dog to teach that at all.
No.
In fact, with a protection dog, you kind of have to make sure the dog understands we're looking, we're not hunting right now. Like, like because that dog that might be a protection dog, is like especially like a Leo dog, like that dog might be trained to find people, and it also may be trained to find people that are bad people. So the dog has to be clear as to what's going on. I'm looking for a little kid. It's lost. I'm looking for a bad guy I need to bite. When I find him, that will be my signal to my handler. When he screams, he'll know to come get the guy. But a dog that's, you know, more of like a homestead dog, I think especially there's people in this audience have 300,000 acre homesteads. And you let the kids run and that's great. And then sometimes you can't find the kid and you're freaking out. Right. You know, and the kid's somewhere, the cell phone's not working, or the kid finally put the cell phone down so you can't call him. Being able to tell that dog, go find, you know, kid name. And that dog will find that kid. And, you know, on a property like that, a kid that they know, if that dog's trained, he's going to find the kid. If the kid's there, he's going to find him like that.
Yep.
You know, and then the kid finds you, that means you get your ass on.
Exactly. And we actually have a module in Canine Academy that's our basic intro to tracking. And it kind of shows you, this is how we introduce the dogs to tracking. Our particular technique, we call it lost handler. So the dog has to have a good recall, and you start with somebody the dog's bonded to. And then one of the other people hold the dog on a flat collar because you want them pulling but not feeling like they're being corrected, right? So you're not on a prong collar here. And the person that they're going to find, quote unquote, says, come on, let's go. And they start to kind of jog, and they go down maybe 25 to 50 yards, and they duck behind something, a car, corner of a building, a bush, whatever. And then the person that has the dog, and we start them on a long line because that's generally what we're tracking on, is we tell them seek them or whatever command you want to use, our command is seek. And then the dog saw where they went, right? And they want to go get to the person. And so they just go and they turn the corner and there they are and yay. And we praise them, good seek, good seek, good seek, in like 30 seconds of praise, right? Yeah. And then we'll do that two, maybe three times until the dog's like, yes, this is awesome. Like, I love this game. And then we'll say, go to the corner of this building, duck behind it, but then go down the wall of the building and duck around the second corner.
Yeah.
So now for the first couple of rotations, the dog turns and they're right there and yay. Yeah. Now he turns and it's like, oh, where are they? They're not here. Yeah. And then they start using their nose to find the person. And once it clicks and you can see it click in the dog's mind, the minute they don't see him, they put their nose down and start searching. And then we start running short meandering tracks and we just build from there.
Yeah, and you have to train this. People think you don't because dogs naturally do it. Well, they do when they want to. You have to make them understand to do it when you ask them to. Because I'm sure you've seen the TikTok videos of, like, hiding from my dog, you know, and the guy's got this beautiful Doberman or something, and he goes in the other room, and he hides behind a door, and he calls him, and the dog comes in, and the dog's like, well, fuck, I guess he's not here. And he goes, because he's not in the mode. If that dog had the training you just talked about, that dog would be like, bitch, you're back there. I know where you are.
Exactly.
Like there is no way you're going to hide like that, especially from a dog, even of just average, like a freaking Chihuahua is going to find you if it's been taught to do that. And I mean, we did it really simple, just like, you know, Belle loves Tegan. So like find Tegan. And then Tegan goes in the bedroom and find Tegan. And she goes in the bedroom and then goes in the bathroom inside the bedroom. And then you got to find her and then, you know, put her out in the yard, go find her. And then she goes right to her cause she can see her. And then around the back of the shed and then, oh, I got to find her. And they kind of start doing this circle.
Yep.
And I think what they're doing, I think there is scent involved, and it's like a radar, and they're tracking like the dissipation of the scent in that general direction. And once they pick that up, then they do it again. And then next thing you know, they're on it.
Yep. Yeah. Cause when you're running straight line tracks, so if someone's just walking and they're kind of walking in a straight line, initially the dog, you'll see them, they kind of run these big.
Exactly.
Back and, forth the scent, and then they'll kind of hone in on it.
Yeah, and then once they're on it.
Like, okay, here it is. And then if the person turns, then they start to loop. They pick up where the person is, and then they do those big S's, and then they kind of hone in on it. So you they are definitely going, it's fading, move back this way. Okay, it's getting stronger. And then they cross over it and they're like, okay, it's fading again. And then they come back. And because, you know, people sometimes think, you know, oh, a dog's tracking. It's like in their brain, they see a neon line where the person was. And it's like, no, that's not how scent works. It's dissipating depending on how the wind is blowing. It may be 100 yards past where the person actually was.
Yeah.
If there's edges, like you walk across a field and you hit the woods, the scent's going to hit that edge and just disperse all up and down the edge.
Yeah.
And all of these are techniques you have to practice so that you and your dog know, hey, when we run into this problem, this is what we do to solve the problem.
Yeah. And it is innate. It's one of the easier skills to teach a dog because, like, if anybody's ever wondered why, like, you see your dog, he runs out into the field, there's something there, it smells good or bad, whatever it is, and the dog all of a sudden rolls around in it.
Mm-hmm.
He's scent marking, or she's scent marking herself.
Yep.
I like this spot, right? You might not like it, but the dog likes it, and the dog has got enough forward thinking, I want to find this place again. So now the scent's on the dog, and now when the dog doesn't remember where it was, it can find it because it's carrying the scent with it for, you know, however long that lasts. Hopefully not too long with some of the things they roll in, but that's why they're doing it. So it's innate, but you have to – it's like a you buy software – it comes with all the features, but you have to toggle the button to turn the feature on.
Yes. Well, the other thing is with dogs, you have to remember tracking and using their nose is natural, but tracking human beings is not natural. So it's very natural for them to go after a deer or a squirrel or, you know, prey animals. They're going to naturally track those prey animals down, a mouse or a rat. But when it comes to human beings, exactly. But when it comes to human beings, that's not the thing they naturally use.
Yeah.
So that's where the actual intro to this is the scent I want you to find right now. And it can be general human scent, like if you don't have an actual scent article, or it can be a specific person, like when you have a child and you want to teach them, you can teach them to track your children by name if you do it frequently enough and they're familiar enough with each child's scent. Or you can go grab a sock out of the dirty clothes and go, this is who we're searching for right now. Like if somebody calls me and says, my child's lost, can you come search for them? I'm like, I want a dirty sock.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't have a dirty sock, dirty underwear or a dirty shirt or something, but I want that scent so that dog goes, this is who I'm looking for. And then they can go and find that person.
So, you know, you have this business, you train these really high end dogs. It's your thing. It's what you do. It's all that you do. You train dogs to rappel out of friggin' helicopters with humans. I mean, it's pretty amazing. But what would you say to somebody out there that wants maybe a business in this space or even a side hustle? Maybe they don't even want to go that far. Maybe they're really good with dogs. Maybe they want to perfect their skills a little bit more because there's a huge market. This is part of why I'm such a fan of Canine Academy, to just make the dog not be a pain in the ass. And to me, this is one of those things that's really needed because it's so easy to do if you do it right. But there's so many people that are vapor locked and they say shit like, but I want the dog to be a dog.
Yeah.
You want your dog to be, you know, fill in descriptive blank ahead of dog. You want it to be a homestead dog. You want it to be a hunting dog. You want it to be a livestock guardian dog. You want it to be a family dog. Well, family dogs don't piss on the couch and tear the curtains down. Maybe when they're puppies and they're learning, but this should not be something you're dealing with at a year and a half of age, 2 years of age.
Right. Yeah, that's one of my most frustrating things. Somebody's got a 2-year-old dog, and they're like, it's still a puppy. I'm like, no, it's not a puppy
anymore. It's like 18 years old, and that was 14, but in legitimate terms, it's like an 18-year-old kid.
Exactly. So if you're trying to start a business in this, I have a couple recommendations, because I have a lot of young guys who will come to me, sometimes young women, and they're like, I want to learn to do the business that you're doing. Well, if you want to go into the protection realm of things, you know, you really need to invest 4 to 5 years with somebody and learn all of the nuance of that. But I am a big fan. You know, a lot of people in the self-defense community are like, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He shouldn't be teaching people to shoot. I'm like, if he knows more than they do and his techniques are you know, valid, then he can charge them for the knowledge he has. You might have more knowledge than he does, but he has more than they do, and if they're willing to pay him to give them that knowledge, then that's a valid thing. So you could do something like Canine Academy and get one or two dogs and just work them through Canine Academy so that you've actually had experience doing that. You can work with another trainer and say, you know, either, hey, can you hire me? Or I'll work for free. I'll volunteer if you're a young person, especially. This is generally how I do my internships, is if somebody wants to learn our techniques and how we do it, is you come and you work with us for, you know, 6 months to a year or 2 years, and I exchange knowledge for your labor. And so when you're here, I'm going to use you, and you're going to do things for me, but you're going to be learning while you do it. And yeah. So, you know, learn the basics. It's good to have experience with multiple different types of dogs, breeds of dogs, different lines of dogs. When I first started training, the people that I trained with, all their dogs were very high level dogs, right? Even from puppy up, their genetics and their lines were very solid. And so the way we did things with those dogs, we could advance them really fast. Well, then I started working with other people's dogs, mm-hmm. and realized, whoa, I can't put that dog in that level of stress. Like, they just crumble and break down. So that was actually really helpful for me, though, because I learned to start reading the dogs a lot better. And then I could tell, okay, this dog's starting to get stressed. Let's back off. Let's work them over here at something they're better at. Then let's come back into the stress. And so we could use that stress inoculation method where we weren't pushing them too far too fast. But getting some experience with a couple of dogs and learning the techniques, and then starting to run some classes so that other people are bringing you their dogs, right? If you feel comfortable doing some like basic obedience and just getting a dog well-mannered, you could do something like a board and train option where you take one or two dogs into your house at a time. And, you know, in the beginning, you're not going to be able to charge as much as the dude who's really awesome and knows everything he's doing. Right. Yeah. So you price yourself at your skill level. And like when I first started this 12 years ago, protection dog was $8,500.
Okay.
And because that's the only price point I could get people to buy a dog from me at.
Sure.
Well, then as my company got more history to it, as people, you know, more and more people heard about us, it went to 10,000, then 12, then 15, then 20, then 30. Now we're selling $75,000 dogs. And because number one, my skill set's improved over that time frame, but number two, the market knows who I am now.
Yeah.
You can go onto my Instagram page and see there's like 8 years of history here. Here's all the stuff this guy's been doing all this time. Okay, he's obviously been around for a while, because a lot of companies in general don't last very long. And so even in the dog industry, this is pretty common. You'll get a company, they'll blow up for a short period of time. They'll be all over the place on Instagram because they're paying for it or whatever. And then 2-3 years down the road, they're out of business. And the downside of that is, well, then all their support that they were providing you goes with it when they go out of business.
Gone.
Whereas if you find somebody who's been in the market for a decade or longer, it's like, okay, they're probably going to be around, you know, 5-10 years in the future too. So they're going to be here either when I want to replace my dog, when it's old and I need a new one, or if I need help and something happens, they're going to be around to help me.
Yeah. There's a lot in that to unpack. The first thing is the whole, is this person qualified to train? Like you said, if you know more than the people you're teaching and what you're teaching is valid, mm-hmm. you might actually be a better trainer for that person than the guy you're talking about, talking shit about him. Like, because there's a lot of people that are like, you know what? I want to start carrying a gun. That's a good example, right? And I want to conceal carry. And I took my state's thing and yeah, I can hit a target at 7 feet, you know, but so can a blindman. I want to actually be more proficient. And that person actually may not want to take a class with a guy. I'm a Navy SEAL, LAPD, SWAT officer. And when I was done being a SEAL, I was Special Forces for 15 years or some bullshit they make up, you know. Yeah. And even if it's all true, okay, so you got a trainer that's at this level. I don't learn a lot by going to a trainer who shows me how good they are.
Right.
I learn from a trainer who shows me how good I can be.
Yes.
Right. So if the guy doesn't even know what the fuck a modified Weaver stance is, right, and all of a sudden you're, you know, like some of the stuff I went to, they like soaked their hands down with shit that made them like oil and like a mix of like oil and tall shit, sticky and slippery, right?
Yeah.
And then create a malfunction and you're having to like feed around off the back of your heel because you can't do it with your hands and stuff like that. You know, we had firing line exercise. We did like four dudes hold you down, one on each leg and one on each arm, and you have to fight for 30 seconds. It gets your heart rate up.
Right.
That guy doesn't need – he's not ready for that.
Exactly.
He's not ready for that level of training. So there's a niche for that basics. And I have found that when people get to a certain advanced level, it's actually – even when they do a basics class, it's very hard to bring themselves down and have the patience for that level. So I think with dog training, if the person wants a dog that doesn't jump on the couch, doesn't bite the neighbor, listens and whatever – you can teach them that, but they probably can't afford it unless right. they use like your remote training, like Canine Academy. They're not going to travel to your facility to learn basic core obedience.
Right.
If that's all they want. So there's a place for that. And there's all these niches, and there's some high money niches other than protection. Go oh, yeah. to where people pay for a freaking well-trained Brittany Spaniel or Springer Spaniel that can point and hold quail.
Yep.
Oh, right?
Yeah. So, and I'm not an expert in that. Like,
no.
I might be able to figure out how to do it, but that's not what I do. So if you are interested in hunting and you really like bird dogs and things like that, yeah, those niches, I mean, that's kind of the one of the really cool things about the dog world is you have everything from the super wealthy women with frou-frou poofy dogs that want yeah. them groomed every 3 days
yeah.
all the way up to, you know, hardcore military guys and everything yeah. in between. So there's, if you like dogs, you can specialize in the kind of dogs that you like, the kind of training that you like. I mean, I know people that have done just grooming. They just set up a grooming business. And they bought a van and they set it up as a mobile grooming business. They come to you and before long they've got 10 vans and they're not the ones doing the grooming anymore. They're yep. sending out their groomers to do it. And a lot of people who work that are, you know, trained groomers for dogs that work in vets, they have very spotty business. Like they'll have a bunch of business one day and then nothing after that. If you can provide them a consistent level of work and they're getting, cause they only get paid when they groom a dog. So correct. Other than that, they're just standing around waiting. You can build a really great business doing that. You know, and you reminded me when you were talking about the Navy SEAL guy and all the advanced training and working with somebody who's got the basics. One of the things I learned years ago was when you're marketing your business, you have to market it at the person, at the level the person understands. So they use the example of a photography course where they were like, we're going to teach you how to use f-stop and blah, blah. And they were using the photography terms.
Yeah.
And they weren't getting anybody to buy their course. Because nobody knew what the hell f-stop was.
If they knew what that meant, they wouldn't be taking your course.
Exactly. So they changed the verbiage to say, we'll teach you how to take pictures with fuzzy backgrounds. And boom, they blew up because, oh, I want to learn how to – those are cool pictures where it's a clear subject and a fuzzy background. Yeah, I want to learn to do that. Well, now you teach them that's called f-stop. But if you started f-stop, even though – because most people are – at like, let's say whatever level you consider yourself at, you're at a 10 and you go, I'm at down for your clients and they go, oh, okay. Level 7.
No, like, no, they're level a zero.
Yeah.
They're a zero.
Way down there. We train dogs to protect your family.
Like,
you'll learn all the other terms when you come and train or through the process. But right off the bat, what do you need to know? We train dogs to protect you and they're safe with your kids.
So this is as basic as it gets for marketing a business. Features tell. Benefits sell, right? It's that simple. Like, you sell the benefit, the feature is part of product support is another way you can look at it, right? Like, because if that person, like you said, was going to take a photography class, knew what an f-stop was, they probably wouldn't be taking a basics photography class. They would be taking an advanced photography class, setting up shot framing or something like that at an advanced level. You can't use words that your market doesn't understand. So I tell people, like, people that go in the permaculture space and they're like, I'm going to open up a permaculture business. I'm like, call it edible landscaping.
Mm-hmm.
Right? No, because the permaculture person you're targeting will know what it means. Right? But the yuppie will go, oh, I want that. And their money's green too. And there's more of them than the initiated. And most of the initiated do things themselves. Right?
Yeah. So, well, one of the things, this just popped into my head, and I don't know why it's never in this terminology popped into my head before. Most niche businesses are not targeting a niche market. You have to target the broad market, and then there's going to be a niche group within that broad market that's going to be interested, especially when you start off. And so if you're, like you said, if you're in permaculture and you're only targeting people who are into permaculture, you're really limiting who's going to find you.
Yeah.
You have to phrase it in a way that the average person goes, I would love to walk out into my front yard and the bushes growing along the front of my house, I can pull things off them and eat them.
Yep.
Like, that sounds great to me. And it looks pretty. Oh, yeah, sign me up. Not the person who's like, I want to develop a, you know, a 200-acre farm or permaculture farm. It's like, yeah, okay, you can market to those people, but there's not nearly as many of them as there are yuppies living in suburbs that would like, you know, fancy yards, but that also they could eat from it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, what do I get out of it? It's non-toxic. It's beautiful. I can eat it, right? That yeah. Permaculture means it sounds like a bunch of hippies rolling in the mud. I mean, I'm as indoctrinated as possible into the discipline at this point, but when I first heard it, it's exactly what I thought. What kind of hippie bullshit is this? Like, if it wasn't for Bill Mollison's old crusty ass and seeing a video of him, I don't know that I would have ever become part of that community. Anyway, you know, this all sounds great, but one of my things I really admire about you is the major setbacks that you overcame. In a lot of ways, you and John Willis are like brothers in totally different timelines that went through some real serious shit to demonstrate resiliency. And that's a huge part of what we talk about here. So as much as you want to say anyway, can you kind of give people like that storyline and what you had to come back from? Because it was pretty much going to zero.
Right. Yeah. The if you want to hear the whole story, Nicole Soss did interview with me where we went through the whole story in detail. But the kind of in a nutshell version is my ex-wife. We were separated at the time. She took some of my dog scent. That was a small block of C4 that I'd shaved a little piece off of, didn't have any of the other components to make anything go boom. We used it for explosive scent for the dogs. She called the cops and said, I was going to create a bomb and blow people up. And so I get arrested. I spend 3 months in jail before I get, what do they call it? It's not probation. It's
parole.
Parole.
Yeah.
And so I get out on that. And essentially when I came out of that, I had nothing. Because while I was in jail, we had, you know, the family court hearings and, oh, well, I can't support the family. She's like, you're not taking care of us. I'm like, bitch, you put me in here. I can't take care of you. But the, so the judge goes, okay, everything that you owned as a family is hers. So literally everything that I had gone. And so then I get out and I have nothing. So it's like, okay, well, I need to start making some money. So I just went on Craigslist or whatever. Cause again, I didn't even have the websites at this point. Everything had been was out of my hands. So just put on Craigslist, doing dog training classes. People start showing up, start making a little bit of money. Then as I worked through the divorce proceedings, I at least got the business names back. So I got the social media, the websites, stuff like that. And then I had to start buying my dogs back from her. So, you know, this is where you have to kind of get creative. When things go wrong, you can't just be like, oh, this is terrible, blah, blah, blah. You have to go, again, it's the whole thing that you talk about, Jack, is stop saying I can't and start saying how can I?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have any money and I wasn't making enough doing the little – because I started getting clients pretty quick. I had 6 or 8 clients that would come to me, you know, about every week or every other week for some training. So I was making a little bit of money and I'm like, okay, how do I get my dogs back? Well, I called my ex-wife and I said, okay, send me these 2 dogs and when I sell them, I'll give you half the money. Well, she would send me those 2 dogs and I would sell one and give her all the money and keep the other dog as one of my breeding dogs. And I kept doing that. Send me these 2. I'll send you half when I sell them. And I kept selling one and giving her all the money and keeping the other dog because now I can start breeding. Now I can start producing my own dogs. Now I can start creating the dogs that I'm going to sell and I don't need to go get them from her. And so that took me probably a year or a year and a half, maybe even 2 to get all the dogs that I wanted back. And by that point, I had the facility. Well, I had the business up and running again. And one of my clients had a little kind of a training space that she trained dogs in. And she wanted me to come and train there. So we went and we looked at it. And I said, okay, this is a nice little location. Like, how much do you want to charge for me to train here? And they were like, well, right now, we just want to come to the classes for free. But you can have everybody else pay to come to the classes. I said, okay, sounds like a good deal to me. I did that for like a year. And then about a year in, they said, well, we want you to like work from here. We want to build a kennel and we want you to work from here. And so we built that up and the kennel got built and everything. And then eventually down the road, they were like, well, now we're going to sell the property. And it was in like an ideal location in Florida. It was in the Orlando Metroplex area and it was 20 acres of just land surrounded by cities. So when it got sold, it ended up going for like $27 million or something like that. And then we had to relocate again. And that was kind of, it was a little bit of a surprise. Like they gave us a little bit of a heads up, but then it was kind of like, well, we're thinking about it. We don't really know. Like they hadn't really fully locked in till they were going to sell it. And so when it came down to, yep, we're doing it. It was like, oh shit. Like we've got like 6 months to find a new location. And, but then again, it's like, I could go, oh no, everything fell apart. This is terrible. Or I can go, okay, what do we need to do? We found another location. we started moving, and then we're leasing again currently, and I go, okay, I don't want this to happen again. So now what's my plan for the next 3 to 5 years to have our own place that we move into, and we don't have to worry about leasing property from somebody else that can potentially, you know, go away in a relatively short time frame. But, you know, people ask, like, how do you deal with the pressure of that and the stress of those kind of things happening? I think part of it was going through the military and going, you know, one of the things the military is really good at is teaching you how to suffer. And, you know, Army is
very good at that. Yes.
Embrace the suck, right? Embrace the suck. If you can embrace the suck, you can do almost anything you need to do. And the other thing is, you know, you talk about having, you know, resiliency in terms of being able to function for 3 to 6 months without needing outside income. Whether that's, you know, having your food stores in place, whether it's having your savings in your bank account, all of those things are really important. And when things go wrong, if you have that in place, you have the ability to go take a deep breath and make a plan. You don't go immediately into panic mode. It's when you go into panic mode, you start making really bad decisions. And then oftentimes you end up worse because you didn't get yourself, you didn't do the things that you needed to do. If you can take a deep breath, make a plan to move forward, and then start doing those things. And then one of the things I mentioned, this was at Nicole's workshop this spring, is the way you see things. I actually learned this from Jordan Peterson. The way we perceive things is by setting aims and setting goals. Now, some people just go off their whims and they're sitting in their living room and they go, I'm hungry. Well, then everything in their perception becomes go find food, right? Mm-hmm. Go check the fridge, go through the cabinets, whatever. But if you deliberately set your aims, then once your brain has an aim in mind, this is what I need to do, everything you perceive either becomes a tool or an obstacle. Mm-hmm. Your people become friends or enemies, you know, and then anything that doesn't fit one of those categories, friends, enemies, tools, obstacles, your brain just, it doesn't exist. Because most of what our brain does is it ignores everything around us. If we focused on everything that was around us, we would be completely overwhelmed all the time. Right. I'm in a room that has a shelf with clothes on it, and there's a bed, and there's a dog, and there's things all around. And if my brain focused equally on all those things, I wouldn't be able to function or do anything. So most of what our brain is doing is ignoring most of what's around us. Well, how does it pick what to focus on? Either you let your whims decide, and it's I'm hungry. I'm, you know, I want to go outside and go for a walk, whatever. Or you pick it deliberately, and you basically tell your brain, focus on these things, and then it starts presenting all these things in front of you. You know, I use the analogy when I was riding mountain bikes. If I tried not to hit trees,
I hit trees. Yeah,
because
yeah,
your brain doesn't have a negative function.
That's why so many cops get hit by cars.
People
see the lights, and I can't hit the cop. Boom, they hit the car. It happens all the time.
All the time. In fact, when we were taught how to do traffic stops, one of the big things they spent time on is how do you position your car so that if it gets hit, you don't get run over by it. But the minute I started going, pick the path, follow the path, all of a sudden the trees weren't, I mean, you had to avoid them a little bit, but it was much more smooth and you flowed down the path because there's paths all over the place. But when I focused on trees, there's also trees all over the place. And you go, don't hit a tree. Your brain just hears tree. Focus on trees. And then you run into them. So don't do a negative thing. Always make it positive. Where do I want to go? And then your brain starts going, okay, here's all the ways that we can get there. That's why that asking that question, how can I, is so important. And the way your brain functions is because if you go, I can't do X, then your brain goes, okay, we can't do that. Got it. End of story. No problem to solve here.
I'm not going
to
waste any more computing power on doing this because you just gave me the command. Don't.
Yeah.
Right. And I think there's also like a real-time feedback by setting a target, and that makes the mind engage. So if you and I are walking along a path and neither one of us picked the path, we just like we're taking a walk in the woods and we're just walking down this path and we're like, if I turn to you and say, are we getting closer? You're going to look at me like I'm retarded because getting closer to what?
Yep.
But if we have a really long view and we can see a lake at the end of the path and we know we're going to the lake, I'm not going to ask you for getting closer. You're not going to ask me because both of our mental computers are watching the distance come together and we're less likely to go fart around out in the woods like because we're going to the lake.
Exactly.
So we're going to stay on the path on the way to the lake, and there's this real-time computer feedback mechanism going on. And you think that doesn't matter that you set this goal for 2 weeks away. That's not that, but it does matter because your mind is telling you, hey, why are you binge watching TikTok?
Exactly.
Right. Where if you don't give it something else to do, well, let's binge watch. Okay. That's what we're doing.
Yep. Yeah. If you don't have a focus, like a guy I used to listen to a long time ago would say, his dad would tell him, if you don't have a destination, any train will get you there.
Yeah.
And once you have a focus, the other thing that I was learning as I was researching all this stuff is positive and negative emotions are directly affected to goals. They're directly connected to goals. So if you have hardly any goals in your life, it's real easy to get depressed because there's nothing to focus on. But what your brain does is if you have a focus, we're going to the lake and you're walking along this path. And every time you crest a little hill, the lake is closer. Every time you see that lake closer, you get a, we're doing it. We're getting there. We're accomplishing the goal. And if you're walking toward the lake and all of a sudden in the path is a ravine, now you go, uh-oh, now there's something I didn't expect. Yeah. You've got to work through this. You get some negative emotion. But then if you take that deep breath and you go, how do we get around the ravine? Okay, we got around the ravine. Now you get another big spike because we overcame the obstacle. Now we keep going and we keep moving toward it. And so a lot of what causes people to fall out of pursuing the things they want to pursue is the negative emotion. And, you know, oh man, I really wanted to do that. Now I'm disappointed or it didn't work out the way I wanted. And then they quit. And it's because they're not keeping their mental focus on what is it that I need to do. You are going to hit obstacles. Yeah. 100%. You're going to do it. Don't start the journey thinking it's just going to be a smooth ride. You're going to fail. You're going to do a thing and you're going to think this is going to be great. And when I do this thing, all this wonderful stuff's going to happen. I'm going to send this email out. And when I send this email to my group of 200 people, I'm going to sell 20 of my products. And you send the email out and nobody buys shit.
You get one email back and it says, don't bother me with your bullshit.
Yes.
And it was the person you were sure was going to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you go, okay. What did I do wrong?
Yeah.
I need to change the verbiage. Maybe the product I have isn't something that they're interested in. Maybe you need to have a different product.
And more people to send emails to. Maybe I need a different list. I need a different, like, you're going to find something. Cause like, let's go back to your analogy with the ravine. We're taking that walk and we're not going anywhere. We get to a ravine and it looks kind of steep and a little dangerous and sketchy. Well, I guess we're done. There's no real incentive for us to get across that ravine other than like maybe 20 years ago when we were both younger, we were like, we'll do it just to fucking do it. Cause we're stupid. Right. But in a more mature scenario, like there's no reason. But if we wanted to get to the lake, the first thing we start doing is looking up and down and is there a way across? And then the calculation becomes, is it worth the risk and the effort to get to the lake? So is the goal important enough to get over the ravine? It's really simplistic. And it's kind of strange that, you know, you tell people this stuff and there's even resistance to it, right? Like it's so innate. Let's keep moving though, because we've been on quite a while. Can you talk about for preppers why dog training is an important discussion, even if they don't want it like a protection dog?
Yeah. So a couple of things that are really important when it comes to that kind of stuff. If you just have a pet, right? Yeah. I just have a pet dog. There's a hurricane coming. There's a wildfire coming. There's something that me and my family, and we love our dog and we don't want to leave our dog behind. So me, my family and my dog have to leave and go to XYZ place. You get into a hotel, the dog's never been trained in any kind of obedience. It starts ripping things up, causing all kinds of damage. You're either going to have a big bill to pay at the end of that visit, or you're going to get kicked out.
Yeah.
Right. Or can you even get your dog in the car? Right. Has your dog ever ridden in the car before? Can they get, when they get in the car, do you live on twisty, turny roads and they're going to vomit six times on the way to the hotel? Or do you live on nice straight lanes and they're going to be okay? So having your dog exposed to basic kind of life stuff, right? Getting in and out of a car, riding in the car, having a basic level of obedience is really important if you need to get up and go somewhere and you don't have a remote cabin that's yours, you know, out 100 miles away or whatever. And so having that obedience just makes doing that much better. The other thing is having dogs around, especially if you have kids, having dogs around when everything seems to be falling apart and it's obvious that mom and dad are both stressed and kids are scared and they don't know what to do, and they can snuggle with the dog and they can pet the dog and they can lay down and just, you know, have the dog be there with them really helps bring that stress level for the kids down. And sometimes for adults too, right? There's a lot of adults that are like, I just need to sit down and pet my dog for a few minutes so I can relax. Now the other things you're going to want to make sure you do if you're, you know, taking your animals with you in these situations is part of your preps for having everything packed up and ready to go in a go bag. If you live in a place where you have to evacuate, is make sure there's dog food, make sure there's some extra bottles of water for them, make sure you have some bowls. You know, and if you're going to be in a place where maybe you probably shouldn't be going to a shelter, but if you have to go to a shelter, is there a little spot that the dog can lay on, right? If you have any kind of a disability at all, even if you're not really interested in having a quote unquote service dog, if you actually have a disability and can get your dog certified, there's no real certification for service dogs, yeah, but you understand the laws well enough that like, this is my service dog. Even if you have to go to a place that they're like, we don't accept pets, it's not a pet, it's a service dog. So kind of having that in advance where you know, hey, we're set no matter what happens here, could be a big thing. Also, if there's extra threats in those situations, again, even if your dog's not trained for protection, dogs are deterrents as a general rule. Now, maybe not a yippy dog, but if you have any kind of medium-sized to large dog, most people don't want to mess with a person that has a dog with them.
See, so to me, even the little yippy dog is valuable because what the yippy dog does is hear the sound outside the door and make noise, and most criminals make some sort of, you know, reward versus risk calculation, and noise is not their friend and they know it. Now, that doesn't mean some malicious person that just wants to harm you won't, but everything you can do to stack the deck in your favor is better.
Yep, exactly. So, yeah, on the prepper side, the downside to having a dog is there's some extra needs required in terms of feeding them. But the upside is security increases, comfort level increases, and the ability to just have that extra awareness around you all increase, which especially in a high stress situation can be way more important even than in regular daily life. Because I mean, the fact of the matter is, if I sell you a protection dog, I hope you never have to use it, right? Yeah. If you buy a gun, I don't buy a gun so I can go kill somebody. Yeah. I buy a gun for protection, but I hope I never have to use it. But in regular everyday life, there's all sorts of other benefits that come along with them.
Yeah, the alerting capability alone is huge. Kind of what we learned from you is how to shut it down without stopping it.
Right.
Like, good alert. He's okay. He's bringing your treats from Amazon. You don't have to kill him now. Just relax. But I love that alert. And then the ride thing. I've talked to a lot of people. My dog hates the car. My dog hates the car. My dog hates the car. Well, where do you take the dog in the car? The vet and the groomers.
Yep.
Well, if the only place you took me was the dentist in the hospital, I'd freaking hate the car too.
Right.
So put the dog in the car and take him good places. We, you know, if you go to Starbucks, get him a puppy cup, right? Don't do that all the time. It'll make him fat. But once in a while, like, or take him to a park and take him for a walk and make him an exploration. Take him out somewhere that they want to be. So the car is associated with good things.
Exactly.
And the earlier you start, the easier it is. A dog that goes in a car as a puppy almost never has problems as an adult dog going in a car. A dog that's barely been in the car, the first time you put that dog in a car, it's like a year and a half old. It's like, this is all foreign to me. I don't understand this. You know, I don't like this.
Yeah, they don't understand why they feel like they're moving, but they're not moving, but everything looks like they're moving.
Yeah.
And like, think of it as like a 2-year-old kid or something like that who's never been in a car before.
Yeah.
Like they didn't get driven around as an infant. And all of a sudden they're like, whoa, why is the world moving?
Yeah.
And so I will give a couple recommendations. If you haven't ever ridden your dog in a car and or you've done it a few times and they keep getting sick, plastic crates are a really great way of introducing a dog to riding in the car, because when they throw up, it's way easier to clean than between your seats.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing to do. Another thing is some dogs, just like people, will start to get it's a mental thing. It's like, oh no, we're getting in the car. I throw up in cars.
Yeah.
So if your dog throws up in the car the first time, what I do is we use a medication called Bonine. It's very similar to this is what it is right here. Bonine. You can get it at Walmart. And you give that to your dog about 30 minutes before you go. It's a motion sickness medication. I can't remember what Dramamine or whatever the other one is for boats that people use. It's safe for dogs. And you give them that, you wait about 30 minutes to an hour before the drive. And usually if they come off it even like, so we'll give it to our young dogs on a road trip, right? Yeah. It only lasts a couple hours, but if they were in the car as it comes off, they tend to be good.
Yeah, they're good because they were always doing it.
But it also, if they're throwing up, if you can get them, you know, 5, 6, 8 times in a row where they don't throw up, then they're not thinking the second they jump into the car, oh no, this is where I throw up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so mentally, they're not expecting it. So
yeah.
They get used to the motion in the car. And then once they've been in their crate 4 or 5 times and they haven't thrown up, then you can start letting them have the back seat or something like that. Also, letting them see out the front window
helps
a lot of times.
Yeah, just so they can see, period, right? Like, so like the way I try to explain it to people so they understand how the dog feels is every driver's had this experience. You're sitting in a parking lot. The person next to you gets in their vehicle. You didn't see them.
Right.
Their vehicle's really quiet, so when they start, you have the radio on, you didn't hear them start it up.
Yep.
They start backing up, and you see out of your peripheral vision that vehicle moving, and it feels like your vehicle's, and you like hit the brake or some shit, which is stupid. Your car's not even running, right? Yep. And you're on a flat surface. There's no way it's going anywhere, but you still do it. Okay, now imagine that feeling not going away.
Right.
That's where
it doesn't have any control.
You can't stop it. You keep feeling that way, and it's been going on, and you have no control. You're not behind the wheel. You're next to your person.
Yep.
And so that's why we have to like work through it with them. Now I've got some, before we do some audience questions, I've got some questions from artificial intelligence, AI. I've been doing this with my guests, right? Like I give them all the information about you and then say, give me 2 real world serious questions and 1 just fun question.
Okay.
So your first ChatGPT real world serious question is, what do most people get completely wrong about a protection dog when starting out?
If you're starting out looking into protection dogs or you find out about protection dogs, probably the biggest misconception, although it's not a misconception in some scenarios, but is that if a dog bites a person on command, it's also unsafe around other people.
Mm.
The big warning there is if the company you're getting a dog from has not trained their dog to both bite and be good around people, then that can definitely be a problem.
Sure.
But that's one of the things we focus on is you have to be good around the kids. You have to be good around the other dogs, the puppies, the cats. But when I tell you to bite, you bite.
Yep.
And but that's probably the biggest misconception specifically around protection dogs is if they've been trained to bite, then they're not safe around other people. And while that can be the case, if the dog's been trained specifically for that, it's definitely not the situation.
I would actually say if the dog's trained right, it's probably less of a concern because people get bit all the time by non-protection dogs, right? That's just that dog loves kids and that kid is on top of that dog and that dog's ears are back.
Yep.
Right, we've talked about this before. Dogs almost never bite out of nowhere.
Exactly.
I don't know what happened. They just bit.
Out of nowhere. It never comes out of
nowhere. That dog's body language was screaming probably for minutes at least before that bite happened, and you didn't see it because you didn't think it would happen.
Well, one of the biggest benefits we have in training is when our clients are here picking up their dogs, we'll do some bite training where the dogs get to bite, and then we'll tell the person, okay, now tell the dog to sit at your side and tell them to leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to move around with the bite equipment on, but the dog is not to bite me. And if they bite me, they get a correction. Well, I always set up one where – because you can always push the dogs to bite at some point, right? Things that you'd never let happen in public without – like you'd want your dog to bite. But in this particular setting, the dog's been told not to bite.
Yeah.
And I can look at the dog and be like – because they're going to leave it and they're new to the dog still, right? The dog's not bonded to them. Like, who's this stranger told me to leave it? And I really want to bite that guy right now. And I'm looking at him and I'm like, that dog is definitely not leaving it. But I will deliberately walk right in and I'll agitate the dog and let them fail. Jump up and bite, and I look at the person and I go, because they were typically going, good, leave it.
Yeah.
And
no.
Whatever you were seeing from your perspective
was not
that was
it.
Not leaving it. Right? But what happens when you run a couple of those drills is the handler becomes aware of the dog's body language. Oh, this is what they're doing when they're leaving it. If they're doing this, they are not leaving it. And so once you're aware of that, like you said, it's like the dog's been screaming body language, but so many people are oblivious to it because they've never experienced it before.
Yeah.
And then when they do experience it, to them it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But the dog was telling them all along, but they have to learn to read that body language before it happens.
Yeah.
So if you do bite work with a dog and the trainer that you're working with does stability exercises like that, you learn when they're leaving it and when they're not leaving it.
Yeah.
You can tell when they're tense and when they're relaxed.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Next AI question, serious one. Is there a real-world story where one of your trained dogs made a serious impact in some way?
Yes. So I've never had a client call me and say, my dog ripped somebody up and like saved our lives. I think that goes to the deterrent factor of the situation. But I have had numerous calls and contacts from people where one specifically was we had a couple. They had two young children, and they were traveling across the country at the time. They had one of our dogs, and somebody came up and was asking them for some money. And we actually run scenarios like this when we do our scenario training. And, you know, most of the time you tell a person, sorry, I don't have any money right now, or I don't have any cash. And they're like, oh, okay. And they move on to the next person. Well, this person started getting super belligerent with them and was yelling at them and started moving in closer. And they had just got their kids loaded into the car and kind of buckled in because they were still in those car seats. And they started raising their voice. And it was like the husband was dealing with the person and the wife was trying to get the kids in the car. And at first it didn't seem like that big a deal, but then it started escalating. And she grabbed the dog and took the dog out of the vehicle. And the second the dog jumped out of the vehicle, and the dog was hearing this, of course, while they were in the car. So the minute they jumped out, they went to the end of the lead. And they were like, I'm going to fucking smash that guy. And the person saw the aggression in the dog's eyes. They had it on lead, so it didn't go and engage. But they were just like, oh, never mind. Okay, I want to get out of here. And I've had variations of that. I had a person use the dog to chase Mormons off their property because they wouldn't leave one time. Which, you know, trespassers, you know, they kind of fall in that category. We run a scenario where we push trespassers off the property without biting. But there's things like that that we get those kind of stories all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Here's the fun question. This is actually pretty cool for AI to come up with, right? If his dogs could talk for a day, what would they say about living and working with Joel?
I think they say the thing that Nicole always says when she introduces me. He's an asshole. I think my dogs love me, but they also at the same time are like, don't screw around when this guy's here. It's like, you know, being in basic training all the time. And when the drill sergeant walks in the room, everybody's like, oh, he's here.
Yeah.
And then they go home to their families and their families aren't quite as strict. And then they come back for their follow-on training. And the dog's like, oh, we're back with the drill sergeant guy. Like, got to behave. And they definitely kind of have that personality. Like, they love it when I'm there and they want me to pet them and everything. But the minute I say something, they're like, oh, like, he's giving commands. If I leave the room and it's just Wendy and the kids, they're like, oh, what can we get away with? Like,
what can we get away with now? Yeah, the drill sergeant. We got the substitute drill sergeant who's on, like, the last week of their tour and doesn't really give a shit anymore. He's not responsible for us.
Exactly.
That type of thing. I mean, he knows how to do the job, but his heart's not in it, so we could get away with some shit, you know?
Yep. Kick isn't too far, but you can get away with a few things.
Yeah. Okay, so actually quite a few questions come in. Let's kind of lightning round these because we're at an hour 40 right now.
All right.
Our German Shepherd American Bully mix is 3 years old and a great homestead dog, so protective of the animals and us. Is she too old to train? And obviously this dog is trained. They're actually asking protection training. I don't know that they're ever too old, but they're not optimum.
Yeah, 3 is probably right at the limit. Maybe 4. So the question I always ask, first of all, we would do a quick evaluation of the dog and see if it was going to come out fairly quickly. At that age, if it doesn't come out fairly quickly, it's not going to, most likely. And if it comes out fairly quickly, then the big part is you build the bite work a little bit and then you start putting the stability in right off the bat. And then you can work that till it's at a level that you're comfortable with. I always, whenever somebody says, my dog's X old, is it worth doing X training? I always go, well, about how long is that training going to take? And are you going to get the benefit of the training out of the dog over the remaining part of its life when it's done? Yeah. Or is the dog going to go through that stress of the training and then basically die right at the end of it because it's at the end of its life? 3, you know, most shepherd bully mixes, they're probably going to live to 12, maybe 15 in that range. Yeah. So you're still pretty early in their life. It's like, you know, my child's 20. Is it worth them learning to fight or do a martial art? Probably. Yeah. And as long as they, you know, they don't show an aversion to it right off the bat, then they'd probably do okay if you had a good trainer.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is there's a harshness to this type of training, and it's easier to do when the dog's 4 months old.
Yeah.
And it weighs, you know, 25 pounds than trying to deal with it when you've got a dog that size. Because there's a point where you get that dog to engage, and it doesn't stop.
Right.
And, like, you'll basically string them up, right? And that's pretty easy to do with a 25-pound pup.
Yeah.
It ain't so easy to do with a 3-year-old bulldog Shepherd mix.
When people bring a dog to me that they have that they want to train for protection work, the no matter what, the first thing we do is spend a day making sure they have a good level of obedience. And I put them in situations where them and the dog are going to be stressed to see if the dog is going to challenge the handler.
Yeah.
Because if the dog is challenging the handler, that dog doesn't get trained to bite. That dog has to be trained to respect the handler first, and then we can start putting bite work into the dog. But a good trainer is going to do that evaluation with you before they start teaching a dog to bite.
Now, the one thing you could do with a dog like that, though, there's really never too late to train because this is not stressful for the dog, and that's to teach the dog to act like it's trained to bite, right? To be completely responsive, to posture properly. I had this Brittany Spaniel when I was much younger. That dog, I could put him on you and say, watch him.
Yep.
And you weren't going to move without that dog showing teeth and growling. And if you would have walked up and pet him, he would have just growled at you. He would have never bit you.
Right.
But you don't know that, right? So, you know, things like that are not necessarily going to save you in a really sticky situation, but they might and actually have a high probability, just like the story with your daughter, of preventing it. If somebody sees a dog that looks the type, that's acting a certain way, it's like, I don't really – and it's amazing. You've talked about it before. Like, really big, tough guys that have been shot and shit, right?
Yeah.
They don't want to get – nobody wants to get bit. Somebody asked earlier how many times have you been bit, and I said, do you mean like suit feathers? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, more than a couple times. I've seen pictures.
Oh, yeah.
It's not
fun. Eight or ten good solid ones and a bunch of little scratches.
Yeah, yeah. Not sure if the wording is right, but who or what kind of trainer organization do I look for to train a dog for scent? I think as we were saying, you could do a lot of that on your own. That's not that hard to do.
You can. There's a lot of organizations around. So scent work is becoming a lot more popular. There's organizations that do it just for fun. So literally they look for like lemon scent or things like that.
Yeah.
And a lot of those are associated with companies that do sport training. Okay. So and it's just another way for them to make money, right? But if you just want to do stuff with your dog and you want to engage and have some fun doing scent work, there's a lot of companies that have that type of stuff. Look up online nose work. That's a common term they use for it, nose work for the dogs. And then once you find those places, you can start honing in on if you actually want to do like tracking, then you can focus in on that. If you actually want to look for narcotics to make sure your kids aren't hiding drugs in the house, you can focus on something like that. But you can narrow it down once you kind of get into those organizations. But it's a pretty popular thing. Search and rescue itself is a little harder to find. And most of the search and rescue groups that are out there are just total bullshit. It's like fat women in spandex on groomed fields. And it's like, people don't get lost on groomed fields, and you couldn't move through the terrain that people get lost on anyway. But you know, if you're doing it as just a social club, great.
Yeah.
If you're actually thinking I'm going to go find lost people, probably not in those situations. But it really is just what are you looking for. But nose work, scent work, and dog tracking are things I would search for online and see if you can find some local stuff.
Mustanger 65, what do you think about dew claws?
So almost all of our dogs' dew claws are functional. So if they can flex them, it's kind of like a thumb, right, on their claws. So if they can flex them, then I don't do anything with them because they use them a lot when they're climbing on things and stuff like that. They will use them to grip. If they're just dangly, right, then where most people remove those is if you're going to be doing things where there's a high probability it's going to get hung and ripped off.
Yeah.
If that's a concern, then you can have them removed. If it's not a concern, like they're just a household dog or whatever, it's not that big a deal. I've even seen some that are so dangly on dogs that they literally fall off on their own.
Yeah.
After the dog's like a year old. So you can look at them, and if they're just like hanging there totally limp, then if you want to have them removed, you can. The main reason to do that is if they're going to be doing a job or a task where like maybe you hike a lot or something where you're out in an environment where they could get ripped off. And you don't want the dog to experience that pain. They can give them a little Novocaine shot. They just snip them off and treat it like a minor wound.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've never, with any dog, ever bothered with it except our hunting dogs. Because a hunting dog's drive in the bush, the stickers, the burrs, the briars, everything, they can catch and they will rip them right off. And it's really painful. And it's just one of those things. Like, that dog's never going to be trying to climb over a wall.
Right.
Like a protection dog or an executive protection dog might, or a military dog. So they don't need it for that function, and it's a liability. It's kind of like, I don't know if they still do it, but they used to. Like, if you went in the Navy, if you became a submariner, you had your appendix out.
Got it.
They were just like, you know, you having an ruptured appendix when you're, you know, 2,000 foot under the ocean water or whatever, like, we just don't need to deal with that. So I don't know. Again, I don't know if they do that anymore. Submarines are much more advanced. There's surgeons on them and stuff now. But that was like back in the original beginning of submariner warfare. You're a submariner, you get your appendix out. Hoga says, what equipment do you train the dogs and need when the dog is trained, i.e. long leads, short leads, harnesses, et cetera? You answer that. But before you do, I want to show people your leads. Because to this day, this is all I use now are Joel's leads. So he has these leads. He makes them in 1 inch or 3/4 inch width. They have a really heavy brass clip. I'm describing this for the audio people. Really heavy brass clip on both sides of it. And then they have a brass ring that floats up and down. And you can explain why if you want to. But to me, that lead, you can't buy that lead in a store. Somebody else might make something similar. The only that I've seen of that quality, and I've got half a dozen of these things, and it is the only thing that I use on my dogs.
Yeah, and the only time we've ever had one of these leads damaged is when the dogs chew them. So if you make sure your dogs don't chew leads, then you'll be fine. And they last a really long time. So the reason we have the floating ring on there is we call them multi-purpose leads. So We can do everything with these leads, from make a temporary harness for a dog for lifting and lowering and search and rescue, to I'm walking and I'm coming to a park. We're having a picnic with the family and I want my dog to be tethered to something. I can take the clip and the ring and go around the picnic table leg and I can tether the picnic table leg. And then if a cat walks by or we're at a public park and a dog walks by, I don't have to worry about my dog getting up and going and checking the other dog out. Right. I can also put it over my shoulder if I need to be hands free, but I want the dog connected to me. I put them around shopping carts when we take the dogs out in public and they just foos along the carts. But the basic equipment that we use is we typically have a flat collar on the dog, which is just what people would think of as a standard collar. And then we use the Herm Springer prong collar, which are on our website if you guys want to purchase one of those. And then we use a standard lead, which is typically 6 or 7 feet long. Yep, so the modern Icon collar that Jack's showing right there is a rigid collar. Those are my preferred flat collars because they hold the prong exactly where you want it to be. If you use a standard, like a 1-inch biothane collar, they work, but a lot of times if everything's not sized just right, then the prong collar can end up over top of the flat.
Yep.
And if you need a correction and you go to pop the dog, it's just pushing into the flat collar and not giving any correction at all. So you have to be aware of that if you're going to use just a standard collar. Now, the modern Icon collars are a lot more expensive than a standard collar. So, you know, depending on how much money you want to start investing into this, you can pick which one you want. But that's what we start off, a flat collar, a prong collar, and a lead. And that will get you started on most things. The next thing that we typically add in, if you're having trouble with a recall or you're having trouble with your dog avoiding you in some of these exercises, is putting a 30-foot long line on them. And you can clip that onto their prong. And then if they try to avoid you, it's easy to step on it or reach it and grab it. And then you can give them a little correction and put them back in their spot. And if you want to know how to use the prong collar, that's all that information is on Canine Academy. We start off introducing, this is how you put it on the dog and this is how you use it. So just as a brief note, the prong collar is only painful to the dog if you give a hard correction. And what it does is it pinches the neck of the dog, which is how dogs correct each other. Right? When a dog does something another dog doesn't like, they go rawr, and they snap at their neck and they pinch them. Now they can do it hard and draw blood, or a mom can do it to her pups and the puppy goes arr, arr, arr. But there's no damage to the puppy at all, right? They have a lot of control over that. And then most of what the prong is its communication. Think of it as a bit on a horse, and your lead is the rein, right? And so you can use it to just gently guide the dog around. You can use it for lead direction. If I'm moving with my dog and I don't want to be talking or I'm engaged in a conversation, but I want my dog to sit, I can just lift slightly up on the lead and put a little tension in it. And the prong is much more feelable to the dog than a flat. Mm-hmm. I also don't want the flat to be associated with anything negative. So if we were talking about tracking, right? If I'm going to track with the dog, I track on their flat collar and I want them to pull in. They'll decide how hard they want to pull into their neck, but I want them pulling, but I don't want that flat to ever feel like it's a correction, because then they're like, oh, I thought you wanted me to look for this scent. I guess you don't. And then they move on to do something else. So the flat is for when I don't want a correction to be felt, or I want to tether the dog out. and it also holds the prong in place. The prong is for communication and correction, and then your lead is obviously there to connect to both of those.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, like, people think it's cruel or whatever, then you don't know what you're talking about, or if you've used it and you think it's cruel, you're using it wrong.
Yeah.
Once the dog knows what it does, you seldom have to actually give it a correction. Usually just, like you said, with a horse, when you're riding a horse and you want that horse to move to the right, you just, your pinky on the rein, and you just touch it, and that horse is like, steers like a car. That dog feels that just, okay, yeah, we'll do what you want to do, boss. Like, it's just instant. Yeah, yeah. The other thing is, if the dog is pulling, and you need to stop the dog, and it pulls on a prong collar, it'll pinch, it'll hurt, it will not choke the dog. If your dog's trying to pull away on a flat, and it's really, it starts choking itself, eventually it'll probably stop, but, I mean, some dogs won't. But no matter how much that dog pulls on that prong collar, it's not going to compress the larynx and potentially seriously injure it. So it's not cruel. It's the exact opposite. It's caring, and it is exactly what the mother dog does. I also corrected just with my hands. You know, I'll just grab and just pinch it real quick. Like, hey, no.
Right.
If you have an adult dog and you've never done that, don't do that. This is something you do with puppies. Yeah. And you, like, I you
saw react
with my dog where I would put him to the ground with my hand. Don't do that if you haven't raised that dog. The dog will take your arm off. You don't be careful what you do. I'm just saying.
We actually have a module or a lesson. I think it's in module 2 on Canine Academy that we added in specifically if you're starting with an adult dog that's never had training.
Yeah.
We do that differently than starting a puppy. So puppies, we almost push to challenge us a little bit when they're pups so that they can learn, don't challenge your handler.
Yeah.
An adult dog, if they challenge you and they try to bite you, the injury potential is way higher, right? And so we deliberately do not frustrate our adult dogs. We have a little more patience working with them.
Yeah.
And I had two dogs that were actually pups that I had sold, that the people had already had a couple dogs from us and they didn't have any time, and the dogs had been there like a year and a half, and they were like, okay, we sucked, we failed, can we pay you to just put basic obedience training into these dogs? And I was like, the only reason I agreed to it was because it gave me an opportunity to train that for Canine Academy and show people, this is how you take an adult dog that's, you know, slightly like cautious around you and stuff. It doesn't really know you that well, and start introducing these commands to it without giving it a hard correction, having it jump up and bite you in the arm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I got one more guy with a question. He's got two. They both are pretty brief. So I'm going to give them both in one go. Kevin says, how do you feel about e-collars? And he also asks about keeping anal glands clear.
So the only time, it depends on your breed. Some breeds have more issues with anal glands. I'll start with that one. The only times I've had my dogs have any issues with anal glands is if they get super aggressive toward their handler. We do give very hard corrections for that. A protection dog that wants to bite its handler is not acceptable. And sometimes when you're doing that, they'll blow out their anal glands. Other than that, the breeds that we work with have never had issues with that.
Yeah.
Some vets will do work on that. I'm not an expert in that area, but I would talk to your vet about that. If you're having issues where they're like constantly blowing them out, then you may want to look into it. If you're not having that issue currently, I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah.
The e-collar specifically. So the two times we use e-collars, and this is for our applications, right? Like Navy SEALs have an application that I think is valid and stuff like that. But the average person is, if I need to give my dog a correction and I don't want to be associated with that correction. So a good example of that is, don't eat chickens.
Okay. Right?
I'll put an e-collar on a dog. I'll let them around the chickens, but I won't be right behind the dog. I'll be kind of off at the distance, but where I can observe. And I have the e-collar turned all the way up because I want those chickens to be able to shock the shit out of that dog. And the dog gets close to the chickens, and I go, pow. And the dog goes, holy shit, that chicken just shocked me.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I don't
yeah,
say
yeah.
anything. I don't do anything. If they come running back, what's going on? And I give them some loving, and I let them go explore the chickens again. And so because if you do it with a lead, they will go out around the chickens and they'll go, is he around?
Is
there anywhere? No? Chickens are fair game.
Yep,
right?
Yeah.
They'll never do it with me. So I don't want to be associated with it so that they're not looking to see if I'm around. They're just like, chickens shock you if you mess with them. So leave chickens alone. And there's other things like, you know, if they're digging in the yard, if they're barking when they're not supposed to, things like that. And you can do it with an e-collar, and the dog doesn't associate you with the correction. They just go, when I bark outside, I get shocked. When I pound on the sliding glass door, I get shocked.
And
so they'll stop doing those things. The other time is if I have a handler who's not strong enough to correct a dog. So if you're trying to use the prong collar and your heart is correcting, because as a side note, one of our philosophies is you use the lightest correction needed to get the desired result. So when you're using a prong collar, it's the lightest correction needed to get the desired result. Now, the desired result is the first time I give a command, I should have to use the lead. And once you do that, you almost never have to correct after that. Once the dog knows, hey, I'm going to get that correction if I don't do the command, I don't want that correction. I'm just going to do what my handler told me to. But so if you're not strong enough, though, to give a meaningful correction should the dog need it, then an e-collar can be an option. I will say e-collars are a lot harder to use than a prong collar in terms of managing the intensity, the timing, everything else. It's very easy to mess that up. And the other thing is, if you make the mistake of putting the prong collar on the dog and going and doing training and it does great, and then you come inside and you take the prong, or the, I'm sorry, e-collar. You put the e-collar on, you go do training, they do great. You take the e-collar off, they're a shit show. Oh no, put the e-collar back on. Okay, they're great again. Okay, now I'm tired of them wearing the e-collar. I'm going to take it off. Oh, they're a shit show again. The dog has learned real quick that when that collar's on, you can give me those shocks. But the second it comes off, I'm free to do whatever I want. You can't do shit. So if you're going to use an e-collar for obedience, what I do is I put the e-collar on the dog, and I don't do anything with it for 3 or 4 days. They're just wearing their collar. It's just another thing around their neck. It doesn't do anything. Nothing happened. And then they forget they're even wearing it.
Yep.
And then after 3 or 4 days, I'll start introducing the bumps and everything else. And you also, when you first get it, should put it on your leg and start off at the lowest setting and go bump, bump. Now turn it up a few notches, bump, bump. You'll feel about 20% because they have different ways that they dial the stuff up, but about 20%, you'll start feeling it's like a tap on your arm. That's what it feels like. There's no pain, and it just feels like a tap. And then you go up about 20% above that, and there's like, oh, that's a slight discomfort, and then it gets more and more as you go. But so know what it does, so that when you put it on the dog, when you first start introducing it, I start low and I dial up a little bit, and I hit it, and I'm looking for the dog to kind of go, like they're kind of like, oh, what's that? And then once they do that, I know, okay, that's there. They're starting to feel it now.
Yeah.
Now I gauge off that for how high and low to go. But it's very easy to screw a dog up with that. So even if you're going to use them, especially if you're starting a puppy, I recommend do it on the prong collar. And then if they get big and strong enough where the prong collar doesn't mean anything anymore, then you can switch to the e-collar, and they already understand the whole command correction dynamic.
Yeah.
And then you just have a moderate setting on your e-collar, and you're just like, hey, I told you to do that thing. You know better. You just give that little bump. And then if they're, you know, decide that they're going to be an asshole today, you can just go, all right, and dial it up and be like, bam, told you not to do that. And they're like, okay, got it. You're in charge. So if you're switching over because you're not strong enough, that's a pretty easy transition. I actually have female clients I do that with, you know, once or twice a year. They'll come in and I'm watching them correct the dog, and I'm like, give a harder correction. And either they have like a leg issue, like a mobility problem or something, and they just can't do it. We're going to go get an e-collar. We're going to do your e-collar intro while you're here.
I'll tell you where it really saved us is Charlie wanted to always kill two things, chainsaws and weed eaters. And if you let them attack the weed eater, pain might do the thing, but you can get pretty hurt by, you know, because you know he's going to come in while it's at full speed from behind you or something, right? So you don't want that. And a chainsaw could be, the dog could be killed, or I mean, thousands of dollars in vet bills. So what we did is we put the prong collar or the shock collar on him, because the prong collar problem is, well, I'm not on the lead right now, so I can attack. Plus, they also think the chainsaw is trying to hurt my handler. That's what the dog's thinking, right? So we took the chain off the chainsaw. We took the string off the weed eater so you could run it, and the dog's not going to get hurt on it. And then we turned it way up because he needed a real correction to understand it. About 3 times.
Yep.
No more weed eater, no more chainsaw. And we would test it, and he'd come, and you'd give him the beep where it doesn't actually go off. And like, that thing hurts. And I'd much rather him zapped a few times, because when you turn it up to the level it needed for that, it was kind of like getting hit by a good electric fence. You didn't like it, right? You didn't like it. It wasn't like the cow electric fence that knocks your dick in your back pocket. It was more like the chicken electric fence. You're like, I really didn't like that, right? Yep. But it saved the dog. Now, I got one more question. I'll let you go. Jesse says, how would you help somebody else overcome the I don't want to, this sucks mentality? And he's talking about not dogs in particular, but kind of the resilience of dog and other. My response, my short response was, you don't. Like, until that person's ready, you know, I don't know if it's a kid or something and they're your kid and you're trying to help them. There's like mentorship there and all. But like, if I'm talking to a grown ass adult and they're in what I call an Eeyore.
Right.
You tell me when you're ready, man. I'm out of here. And then go. I think actually the best way to motivate them is demonstrate in front of them. So that then it's like, well, shit, look, everybody's going and I'm sitting here because I can't breathe for you.
So the only thing I would add to that is if this person is coming to you and asking, like, can you help me? Yeah. You know, how are you so motivated? I have all these problems, but I want to be motivated, but I don't know how to be. There's one of the best books I ever read was called Mind Hacking, and it's by an author. The guy's name is Sir John Hargrave, and he doesn't sound British, so I don't know why he has Sir in front of his name, but that's the author's
name. There's not a square foot of land in Scotland.
You know you could do that, right? Say that one more time.
You know you could do that. You could buy a 1 square foot of land in Scotland. Oh. Company will sell it to you.
Yes.
And then you can be a Scottish nobleman because you own land in Scotland.
Right. And maybe he did that. I don't know. That's his author's name, Sir John Hargrave. Okay. I got the audio book. And he's a programmer. At least he writes the book from the perspective of a computer programmer. And he's basically talking about how to program your mind. And it's with your thoughts. So if you have a negative thought, right, he goes, first he teaches you how to start identifying that hey, I'm having this kind of thought. I'm having that kind of thought. So you start to become aware of the thoughts that are popping into your head. And then when you have a thought that's negative or harmful or not helpful, then you start – now you've identified it and you replace it. And so he starts talking about these loops, these thought loops, right? Because the way – again, we talked earlier about perception – And your aim is how you see things. The way you talk, develop that already, even if you didn't do it on purpose, right? And so you start seeing a thing and you go, every time this happens, I do this and I don't like that I do that. Well, then you start building in a repetition of, well, what should you do instead? Stop saying I don't like it because you're still focused on the thing that's the negative and your brain doesn't understand the negative. That's the tree. If you keep focusing on the tree, you keep hitting the tree. You have to focus on the path. What's the path I want to focus on? This is the thing I should do instead. And then every time something like that happens, you pick the path version, not the tree version. And so he goes through that, and it's a very sequential thing. And then he actually has a meditation practice that's associated with the book, but it's not stupid, like think of nothing. It's first of all, he's teaching you focus your mind. So the first sessions in the meditation is just focus on the breath coming out of your nose for 1 minute. And it's not woo-woo shit. It's teaching your brain to stay focused and not run off. Because try doing that for a minute. And all of a sudden you're like, I wonder if the nose hairs in my nose are sticking out. And you're like, I wonder if my hair is out of place somewhere else. And then you're wondering, how do I make cornflakes? It's like your brain just runs off on these tangents. So you're training it to focus in first. And then you start going, now I want to focus on this specific thing. Now I want to focus on that specific thing. And now that your mind knows how to focus for a period of time, you can focus on the things you want. And it's a really good, quote unquote, I'm not into meditation, like yoga meditation stuff.
Yeah.
But this kind of mindfulness I found super helpful for training your brain to focus on the task at hand.
And just real quick, Jesse said this is a 10-year-old kid. Dude. Part of that's just time, man. 10-year-old kids are not exactly the most motivated in the world. I guarantee he's motivated for some things, right?
I don't think we were born this way.
I wasn't a highly motivated 10-year-old.
No.
Unless I was hunting frogs in the swamp or something. I mean, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and I'm working with my 18-year-old daughter right now, and she really wants to develop some of these skill sets and things. And one of the things that really helps is have them make a plan. So Jordan Peterson has this thing called future authoring, but in a nutshell, it's you're making a 5-year plan. So the idea is first you have to treat yourself like someone you actually care about, because a lot of people think really negatively about themselves. So you're a person that you actually care about and want to help. And then where do you want to be in 5 years? If you could have anything you wanted in 5 years, what would it be? And you can have anything you want, but the catch is you have to identify it and write it down. And he did this with college students entering college, and they had a 50% increase in retention in college. They had like a 30% increase in grades, and it just made this huge significant, because what are you doing? You're identifying the lake.
Yep, you're right? Setting a target.
Not just on the trail walking around. Now we have a destination.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the way I put it is like every day captains get in ships, sail them across an ocean. They end up in the exact port at the exact time with their ship. Maybe they have to deviate around a storm or something, and they're off by a half a day. But in the end, 90% of the ships leave and arrive exactly where we're supposed to, only because the captain charts a course.
Yep.
Don't chart a course. Hey, I'm in Japan, and I need to get to California. It's that way. Get the ship up to speed and go straight. You're going to end up down in freaking South America or something.
Yep.
Right? Like, you got to plot a course. Anyway, Joel, it's been a great discussion. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate you being on with us today.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed it, Jack. Thanks again.
And tell people how they can find out more about you.
Yeah, so our website, if you're interested in purchasing a trained dog or a puppy, is fortresscanine.com, F-O-R-T-R-E-S-S, the letter K, the number 9.com. If you're interested in Canine Academy, go over to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on the banner so Jack gets credit for that, because he keeps giving my website out and not telling people to go to his website and click on the banner. But the canineacademy.us is where that's at. And if you already have a dog and you want to get training there, and then we're at Fortress Canine on almost all the social medias, except for the ones where my accounts got hacked. But if you find us there on Instagram or something, then you'll get directed to everything else from that point.
And I've got a laundry list of Joel on all his socials in the audio notes today. There's a link down in the video notes if you're on the video. If you're listening to the audio and you want to find Joel and you didn't write all that down, look up episode 3690 on the site and you'll be able to get all that information. Joel, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jack.
Bye now. All right, guys, real quick here at the end. You know, I don't have an item of the day for you today, but you guys know you can always help support us by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I am going to real quick put in a plug for my book, Ditch the System, Design Your Life, Laws of Life, by Jack Spirico. This book has done really well out of the gate. It was one of those things, everybody told me to write a book. I finally wrote a book, and then I didn't publish a book, and then I worked on the book some more, and then finally I published the book, and gee, I should have done that a long time ago, but I didn't. And then I finally got it done last month, and it has really awoken in me that there is a big demand for this type of content. Everybody wanted me to write a book on survival and preparedness or permaculture or something like that. But what I really care about is helping people design their life to be more resilient and to build more success into their life. And I got where I am today by following basic principles. And there's 16 laws of life in this book. There's a hell of a lot more of them than that. I'm actually working on laws of life 2 right now. But if you want a blueprint that is a blueprint that somebody doesn't hand you and say, you do these things, you want a blueprint that comes this way, these are the principles of design. Design your own blueprint so you can design your own life, because you know what you want more than me. And here's how to help figure that out at the same time. This is the book for that. The gentleman was asking, a book to help an unmotivated young person. Get this. A 10-year-old kid, probably a little bit above their readiness, but I'd say 14 and up can read this book. There are some bad words in it. There's no big-time F-bomb dropping or anything like that in it. I use euphemisms for the F-word where it's called for, like effing or what have you. But there's a shit or a damn or something like that in there here and there. And it's just because it's real. But if you haven't picked up a copy yet, do so. If you have picked up a copy, then, you know, maybe pick one up for somebody you know that could benefit from it. Like I said, we did have this like version inversion, like the wrong version got uploaded. Somehow I screwed that up, rushing to get it to print, thought it was right. There was some typos in it, some other problems with typesetting. That's been corrected. I don't know if they're shipping the freaking corrected version yet. I did it almost a month ago now. The last copy I bought for myself still had the thing not the way that it's supposed to be. So I'll order another one this week. But if you can get by the typos and all, you know, those are collector's items, because we're going to keep selling it forever, and that's going to stop at some point very soon. Anyway, guys, take care. Tomorrow we'll have an expert counsel Q&A show for the week, Friday flashback, and next week we'll do it all over again. They said you should have a house the American way.
down $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.